Good evening, everybody. A guten Moed, a guten Tag. Thank you so much for joining us to spend time learning Torah together this evening. I'd just like to thank our sponsors for this evening's event. It's sponsored very generously by the Schreier family in memory and commemoration of the first yahrzeit of Mr. Tully Auerbach, Yeshaya Naftali Hertz ben Moshe Aaron, and we hope that his neshama will have an aliyah from all the Divrei Torah that will be shared this evening. My father does not need an introduction, but certainly in our shul he doesn't need one. It's always a great kavod to be hosting my parents for Shabbos, for Yom Tov during the week, whenever they choose to spend time with us. It's always a simcha, but what makes it extra special is when we have the opportunity to hear Divrei Torah from my father. And tonight, the topic that we chose to speak about is the importance of Mesorah. And it's obviously a very timely topic. It's important to speak about. My father, always on Sukkos, shares with us the messages about Hillel, as I'm sure he'll speak about and make mention of, about the importance of Mesorah and how it ties into the celebration of what Sukkos is all about. But we thought there was no more appropriate way to demonstrate how important Mesorah is than to show our reliance on our Mesorah. So the shiur right now is going to be followed by a panel at 8:45, where three chaverim will sit together and just talk about much of the Mesorah that they've gotten from my father, from their rabbeim, talk about shilas that came up over the last week, and how we turn to our rabbeim to give us guidance and to give us a sense of understanding into the very perplexing issues that so often we face in our communities. So I encourage everybody to, if you're interested in that, that's at 8:45. We're going to begin now at 8 o'clock with my father's shiur on the importance of Mesorah. I'm just apologizing in advance. My father has to run out. He has a busy schedule, so he's not going to stay. He wanted to, but we encouraged him that he should get on with his evening, and he doesn't need to hear from any of us because what we're sharing is really all from him. So you shouldn't think it's disrespectful when he's leaving. He doesn't need to give an excuse to leave anyway, but I'm just pointing that out before we begin.
A good night, everyone. The Mishnah tells us that when Hillel, who was the chief rabbi 100 years before the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, Hillel and Shammai, Hillel was the chief rabbi, Shammai was the assistant chief rabbi. So when he would participate in the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, he would make a very strange comment, to Mani Kan HaKol Kan. If I'm here, that's wonderful. Then everybody's here. So Rashi finds that very difficult to understand because the Gemara speaks about the humility of Hillel, how humble he was. So what kind of a statement is that? Mani Kan HaKol Kan? So Rashi has an interpretation that's based on a passage in the Zohar that there are three psukim, consecutive psukim in Parshas Bishalach, right before Kriyas Yamsuf. Each of the three psukim has 72 letters. And if you take the first letter in the first pasuk, the last letter in the second pasuk, and the first letter in the third pasuk, that's one of the 72 names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Take the second letter in the first pasuk, next to the last letter in the second pasuk, second letter in the third pasuk, and so on. So you come out with 72 names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Each name has three letters. And Rashi points out that that's one of the pshatim when we say in Hoshainas, Ani Vahu Hoshia. No, what do the words mean? We spell Vahu, Vei Vav Hei Vav. What kind of a word is that? So one pshat, Ani Vahu, Hu means HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hei Vav Aleph. But if you spell it Vav Hei Vav, what kind of a word is that? So Rashi points out that Ani, Aleph Nun Yud, and Vahu, Vav Hei Vav, are two of the 72 names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he can derive based on these three psukim. I think they say the only source for this is the Zohar. Rashi had the Zohar. It's questionable. The Zohar was discovered during the lifetime of the Ramban. So how did Rashi know what it said in the Zohar? So some say it was added on in Rashi, whatever. It's an issue. So what says printed in Rashi's commentary, Amani Kan, HaKol Kan, if the Ribbono Shel Olam is here, then the Beis HaMikdash has value. He may not need kind of, the Shekhinah is not here, so then the whole Beis HaMikdash is worthless. Okay. But the simple pshat manikan, he says, if I'm the chief rabbi, if I'm here, then everything is fine. So what kind of statement of humility is that? So the Pashtus is that the whole Simchas Beis HaShe'eva, this is a question historically, why do they have such a Simchas Beis HaShe'eva? And the Gemara says that they hardly napped even during Sukkot. They were running, they hardly napped. They would fall asleep on each other's shoulders, and they stayed up. There was a whole schedule all day long celebrating Simchas Beis HaShe'eva. What was the whole Simchas Beis HaShe'eva all about? So the simple pshat in the story was that the tzedukim didn't believe in Nisach HaMayim. The Chumash talks about Nisach HaYayim, but Nisach HaMayim is only known through the Torah Shebal Peh. And we have a lot of other halachas, L'moshe Misinai, in connection with Sukkah, that the Sukkah doesn't have to have four walls. Shtayim kel chosam, shlishis afil tefach. If you have two walls that are right angle to each other, then you can be lenient on the third wall, and you don't even need a fourth wall. And that you say lavud, and you say doifan akuma. There are many halachas L'moshe Misinai in constructing a Sukkah. And even the identification of the esrog is also, it says in the Chumash, priyei tzadar. How do you know any good-looking pri is acceptable? So our tradition has it that it's only an esrog. The Rambam in the Hakdama to the Pirush HaMishnah is divided. The Rambam writes that the Mishnah contains the whole Torah Shebal Peh, and the Rambam says Torah Shebal Peh has five different sections to it. So he said the first section is Pirushim HaMekubalim L'Moshe Misinai. We have certain words in the Chumash that are unclear, and we have a tradition in every language there are certain expressions that have a special meaning. If you take all the words and the expression, you look them up in the dictionary, you put it all together, that's not what it's going to mean. In English, the English language is also like that. Every language has certain expressions that mean something, have connotations that mean something much more than just a translation of each one of the words. So that's what the Rambam writes. Pirushim HaMekubalim L'Moshe Misinai. How do you know what a priyei tzadar is? So the Rambam said that's one of the Pirushim HaMekubalim L'Moshe Misinai. Then the Rambam says another section of Torah Shebal Peh are the halachas L'Moshe Misinai. We have traditions that tefillin have to be black and that bais has to be square and a lot of other halachas L'Moshe Misinai. The Rambam says there aren't so many, and he writes in his introduction to the Pirush HaMishnah, so I'm going to give you the entire list. He says not so many, he gives you the entire list. He left out two-thirds of the list. That's on the bottom of the page where they have printed the Hakdamas HaRambam, the Pirush HaMishnah. He said, they tell you, look, in this sefer, and the Tshuvas of the Chavis Yor, he asked the Kasha, that the Rambam left out the another two-thirds, he left out. He left out more than half of the halachas L'Moshe Misinai. So the Netziv wrote an introduction to all of Torah Shebal Peh. The Netziv, when he was a teenager, wrote a commentary on the She'iltas. Interesting. An Einfeld to write a commentary on the Shiltas. Most people between ages never heard of the Shiltas. But he wrote a commentary, and at the same time he wrote the commentary, the one who later on became his brother-in-law, the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, also wrote a commentary on the Shiltas. An Einfeld, two, they seem to have been independently. Each one had the same idea, to write a commentary. So the Netziv, when he printed his commentary on the Shiltas, he printed it in three volumes, it has Bereshit Shmos in the first volume, and then Vayikra in the second volume, I think by Midbar Devarim in the third volume. So he wrote an introduction to his commentary on the Shiltas, which is really an introduction to all of Torah Shebal Peh. But he wrote it in installments. So he printed the first third in the beginning of the first volume, the second third, the beginning of the second volume, the third third, the beginning of the third volume. When Mosad Rav Kook reprinted it years later, in Eretz Yisrael, so they put all the three parts of the introduction together. So you don't understand why is it in three sections, because originally it was printed in installments. It was written in installments. So in his introduction to Torah Shebal Peh, which he calls Kidmas HaEmek, introduction to his Haemek She'olah, his commentary on the Shiltas, so he comes to defend the Rambam. Why did the Rambam leave out more than half of the halachas L'Moshe Misinai? So he says the Rambam is very careful. Every time the Gemara says halacha L'Moshe Misinai, the Rambam writes in the Mishnah Torah halacha L'Moshe Misinai, and he has it on his list in the Hakdama to the Pirush HaMishnah. So he writes, he lists all of those. Whenever the Gemara says Gemara Gemiri law, so Rashi and Tosfos and the Rosh will write that phrase means halacha L'Moshe Misinai. The Rambam will never write halacha on Moshe Mitzrayim. He writes pi hashmua lamdu. The tradition has it. So the Netziv thinks that the Rambam understood Gemara. Gemiri law means we had a tradition, Gemara. We had a tradition, and we forgot what the limud was. In earlier generations, there was some kind of a limud for this din. And at the time that the Gemara was put together, they forgot what the Alfusa was. But that was the din that was established years ago. So that's why the Rambam is careful. He never writes a two-thirds of what we usually assume according to Rashi and Tosfos and the Rosh. All of these are halachas l'moshe m'sinah. The Rambam says two-thirds of them are not halachas l'moshe m'sinah. They were derived from psukim. And when the Talmud Bavli was put together, they forgot what the derivation was. So that's why the Rambam didn't include it. So the Rambam has five sections to Torah Shabbat. The first is Pirushim HaMkubalim L'Moshe Mitzrayim. He gave, Rabbi Soloveitchik always gave the example of Ayin Tachasayim, but the Rambam gives the example of Pri Eitz Hodah, that it means Esrog, Dafke. And then he says, you have Halachas L'Moshe Mitzrayim. Then you have the bulk of Torah Shabbat Peh is the Dinim that are based on the Yugim Amidash HaTorah Nidresh Hespem. Over the generations, the Tanoim, the Chachamim, Darshan, they came up with new halachas, reading in between the lines based on the Midrash HaTorah and the Drash HaSpam. And then the fourth and the fifth sections, the Rambam writes, of the Torah Shemal Peh, are all the Dinim de Rabbanon, which are divided into two categories, the Gzeris de Rabbanon and the Takonis de Rabbanon. The Gzeris Aloisesei, like Minatori, you're not allowed to carry in a Rishus HaRabim, but you're permitted to carry in a Karmelis. Most Karmelis in our Mokam Tur, Minatorah. And with the Rabbanon, they prohibited Minatoria permitted, if one is a writer, he's permitted to write with his left hand. And with the Rabbanon, they prohibited writing with the left hand. So many, a million and one, a trillion and one Gzeres de Rabbanon. So the Rambam lists off Gzeres de Rabbanon is the fourth category of Torah Shabbat Peh, and the fifth category, yeah, the Takonis de Rabbanon, the Mitzvah Sesim de Rabbanon, that you should light Chanukah candles, you should read the Megillah, you should wash until the Siddayim before you eat bread, and so on and so forth. From the Rambam it would appear, he includes all the Dinim de Rabbanon, the Gzeres de Rabbanon, and the Takonis de Rabbanon, he includes these in the Torah Shabbat Peh. Sounds like Minatorah, that even though the obligation to observe these mitzvahs is only, the Chavis Agav is only with the Rabbanon, it's not Minatorah. And that's why we have a klal Sveka de Rabbanon Lekulam, and there we have a Sofik regarding it did the Rabbanon, you have a right to be lenient. But when you learn those Dinim, that constitutes a mitzvah, Talmud Torah, de Raisa. It's not that it's bittul Torah Minatorah, it's only Talmud Torah Midi Rabbanon. From the Rambam would appear that the fourth and the fifth sections of the Torah Shabbat Peh, the Gzeres de Rabbanon, the Takonis de Rabbanon, become an integral part of the Torah Shabbat Peh Minatorah. It's a Cheftzel Shal Torah, and if a person learns it, he's Mekayim the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Rav Soloveitchik gave a mashal, the Gemara says, in the many disputes between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, so we paskin like Beis Hillel, Ruba de Ruba, we paskin like Beis Hillel. Tosfos says in the beginning of Sukkah, quotes it from the Goyim, that there are six cases only where we pass on like Bishan. The 18 Gzeres in the end of the first Perek in Masechah Shabbos and the Mishnah. And the Gemara says that one fine day, Beis Shammai looked around, they learned in the same Beis Medrash, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. So one day they did like they do in Congress sometimes, they look around and see who's there, and then they ram through a whole bunch of laws that day, because the people are going to give them a hard time and not there. So they voted through. So one day the Beis Hillel was hardly there. There was hardly anybody there. So the Beis Shammai outvoted the Beis Hillel who were there. And they voted an 18 Gzeres de Rabbanon. And the Beis Hillel who were present disagreed. But they were outvoted. But then the Gemara, they were there. Brisa, Pidyon, then whatever, they were Sheva Brachos. They weren't there. Then the next day, when the rest of the Beis Hillel came back, they discussed it again. The Gemara said, the Beis Hillel agreed with the Beis Shammai. He said, that doesn't count. The 18 cases that we pass like Beis Shammai doesn't count as 18 cases because the Beis Hillel finally agreed with them. But there are six cases that the Tosfos in Sukkah Dav Gimel Amud Aleph quotes from the Siddur Rambam going. He lists up the six cases. Two of them are Masechah Sukkah. That's why the Tosfos is in Sukkah. Two by Tzitzis, other things. So there are six cases where we pass like Beis Shammai against Beis Hillel. But in the majority of the cases where we pass like Beis Hillel, and the Gemara said, Mishnah. We don't even consider it a suffix. We don't even consider it a suffix koldahu. They were together in the same base marriage. They were outvoted. So we can't even consider it a halachic dira mekel ba'ovel, halachic dira mekel ba'erev, halachic dira mekel ba'orla b'chutzlords. Not even consider it a suffix koldahu. But nonetheless, When you studied Beis Shammai's opinion, you're in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah on the level of Deraisa. It constitutes a Heftel Shol Torah, even though we know absolutely, we know in advance, we're not going to paskan like the Beis Shammai. But still, the Beis Shammai were not reformed conservative rabbis. They were working with the Midrash HaTorah and the Drash HaSpem. They came up with a different maskana from the Beis Hillel. So because they were working with the Midrash HaTorah and the Drash HaSpem, so what they had to say constitutes a Heftel Shol Torah. So that's what Rav Soloveitchik said. The Dinim de Rabbanon apparently are a Heftel Shol Torah, despite the fact that the Chovas HaGavra to observe them is only mid the Rabbanon, but a Heftel Shol Torah it is min HaTorah. Rav Soloveitchik made this comment for many years. He used to give a shiur for Balabatim on Tuesday nights in Beis HaKnesses Moria. There was a shul in Manhattan on Broadway and 80th Street. There was an office building. So these Balabatim rented one floor and they had the Beis HaKnesses Moria there. Now the office building isn't there anymore. It's part of a clothing store. The whole thing is part of the clothing store. The whole entrance doesn't exist. The whole thing that's all part of a store now. So for many years, well over 10 years, he gave a shiur on Gemar Brachas. So apparently, Rav Elbala Soloveitchik made a comment that one who spends time on Brachas is on the level of the Rais, it's Bittul Torah, it's only Talmud Torah mid the Rabbanon. So maybe it would make more sense to learn Zvachim and Menachas, where Ruba the Ruba of the Dinim are Dinim the Rais, and there are hardly any Dinim the Rabbanon there. So it's more Talmud Torah Deraisa. So Rabban Leib Simon quotes this from Rav Elbala Soloveitchik, and he thinks it's very surprising. He thinks that it's not correct. That's what Rav Soloveitchik taught. It's not correct. When you spend time learning brachas, even though the dinim are only midirabbanan, the chayvus agaba to observe the dinim is only midirabbanan, and sotik brachas lahokel, and dinim midirabbanan, sveka midirabbanan lakula, the chayvus agaba is midirabbanan. But a cheftza shalter, it is mena Torah, and one is in fulfillment of the mitzvah, Talmud Torah Mideraisa, when you learn Dinim Derabban. That's what it would appear from the Rambam, the Hakdamah to the Pirush HaMishnayis, because he's listing off five parts of the Torah Shabbat Peh, and he includes Gzeris and Takonis Derabban. Sounds like it's part of the Torah Shabbat Peh, Min HaTorah. So during the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, we know that there were Tzedukim who didn't accept the Torah Shabbat Peh. And they used to come up with their own opinions. So when they would do Ketzira Sa'imer, they would always start counting Ketzira Sa'imer, V'yam ha'v'yachem v'sayim ha'tnufa, Mimachras ha'Shabbos. So they interpreted that the Ketzira Sa'imer always begins on a Sunday, and Shavuos will always be on a Sunday because it's 7 full weeks. And the next day is going to be on a Sunday, an extended weekend. Like in America, they make the president's birthday, it's always on a weekend. It used to be celebrated in the middle of the week. So now it's one birthday for both presidents, and it's always an extended weekend. So that's what the Tzedukim, so they didn't believe in Torah and Hashemayim, so they said, Moshe Rabbeinu, as if Moshe Rabbeinu invented all the dinim and the Torah. And their line was, Moshe Rabbeinu, Oy v'Yisrael Hayah, he loved the Jewish people. So Pesach, let's say a lot of Jews in America, wealthy people, so they go to Eretz Yisrael for Pesach and for Sukkot. But for Shavuos, what are you going to go just for one day? For 2 days, you're going to go to Eretz Yisrael. It's too expensive. So they only go for Pesach and for Sukkot. So that's what the Tzedukim said. Moshe Rabbeinu was Oy v'Yisrael Hayah. He loved the Jewish people. So when he made up the dinim of Shavuos, he always made Shavuos as an extended weekend. So you go for the whole Shabbos, and then Shavuos is always going to be on a Sunday. So Rabbi Yechem ben Zakkai argued with him. He debated with him. He said, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't make up the dinim, it's all min HaShemayim, and it's not an extended weekend. And the word Shabbos, Merchas HaShabbos, means you start counting Sfira the first day Chol HaMoed Pesach. The word Shabbos in that pasuk means the Yontif. It doesn't mean Shabbos Bereishis, doesn't mean Saturday. It means the Yontif of Pesach. So the Mishnah says when they did the Ketziras HaOmer, so the odds were that it's not going to be on a Metzoy Shabbos. So whenever it's on a Metzoy Shabbos, so the Tzedukim were happy. That's what they always do. You do the Ketziras HaOmer Metzoy Shabbos, and you bring Hakrobas Minchas HaOmer on Sunday morning, and that's when you count Sfirim. And whenever it would not be on a Metzoy Shabbos, then they would make a big Tararam. They would announce in all the villages near the area where they're going to do the Ketziras HaOmer, everybody should come, it's going to be Ketziras HaOmer and a big public hullabaloo. And then when the, and especially if the Ketziras HaOmer is going to be on Friday night, So then the Mechal Shabbos, according to the Tzdukim, the Ktziris Ham is always on a Metzoy Shabbos, and you always start counting Sfira. You always bring the Mincha Soim on a Sunday morning. So the Tzdukim would be upset about that. Whatever, it's any night other than Metzoy Shabbos, and certainly if it's Friday night, the Mechal Shabbos. So whenever the Chachamim would do the Ktzir Saima, they would invite all the villages from the surrounding villages to come participate, and they would make a big fuss about it. And they would ask three times, are you sure we should do the Ktzir Saima? Tonight is a regular night. It's a Wednesday night. It's a Thursday night. It's a Tuesday night. It's a Sunday night. They would ask everything three times, and I should use this sickle, and I should put it in this bag. They would make a big fuss about it to emphasize that we accept, we follow the Torah Shebaal Peh. Yeah, that's why in Shulchan Aruch it says, when Yamata Neder, the Tzukim didn't believe in HaTorah Nedarim. The Mishnah at the end of the first parak in Chagiga says, Het Nedarim, Porchim Bo Avir, Vein Lehem Ameshi Yismocho. Means that it's, the Mishnah holds that it's Halach Al Moshe Messina, that there's no mocker in the Chumash at all. Other Tanoim disagree, the Gemara quotes other Tanoim disagree, and say, no. You can read in between the lines in the Chumash to derive the institution of HaToras Nedarim. HaToras Nedarim, that the husband can be Meifen Didrei Ishto, or that the father can be Meifen Didrei Bita, that's Beferish in the Chumash. But HaToras Nedarim, the Bezen can be Matan Neder, so that's only known through the Torah Shebaal Peh. According to the Mishnah, it's the pure Torah Shebaal Peh. Porchim Boavir, Porchim Boavir, like sound waves are transmitted in the air. There's no way, the Mishnah has no way to read it in between the lines. Purely Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Shulchan Aruch says that since it's only along through the Torah Shebaal Peh, so we should be mechazek it. So when the Bezin says, they should say three times, Mutalach, Mutalach, Mutalach. Why do you have to say three times? One is good enough. Because we have to emphasize that we subscribe to the Torah Shebaal Peh. The Tzdukim didn't believe in HaToras Nedarim. If you look in the Siddur, we have HaToras Nedarim. Everybody practices HaToras Nedarim on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So it has a whole text that the Bezin says, HaKol Mutorim Lachem, HaKol Mechulam Lachem, HaKol Shruim Lachem. So you say that already, you already said three times. Then it says, you should say that three times. That's a mistake. You say it once, you already said. If you say the text in the Siddur, it already says it three times. HaTol Mutorim Lechem, HaKol Shuim Lechem, HaKol Mechulim Lechem. So you already said it three times. No need to say it nine times. That's a mistake what it says in the Siddur. Rabbi Baruch Epstein points that out, but others point that out as well. They don't accept Rabbi Baruch Epstein, the author of the Torah Tamima, has a lot of things that he thinks are misprints. But this one, the others agree with him. This probably is a misprint. You don't have to say the HaTorah Nedarim nine times. Enough you say once. Once it already has three times. So you have to emphasize that we subscribe to the Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Pashta says that that's what the Simchas Beis HaShoeva was all about. The Mishnah records that on one occasion the Kohen Gadol was at Tzduki and he was expected to pour the water on the Mizbech to do Nisach HaMayim. He was consistent. He was convinced that there is no such thing as Nisach HaMayim. So he felt it's not proper to pour it on the Mizbech, so he poured the water on his own feet. So all the people, the Hamaynam, didn't support the Tzdukim. This is only the intelligentsia. The Apikursim were the minority in the days of the Mishnah, the days of the Baisheni. So the Mishnah records, Ragmu called on the Esregehim. All the people pelted the Kohen Gadol, they took their Esregehim, and they threw the Esregehim at the Kohen Gadol. Most of them missed. So they chipped the Mizbeach. They threw some of the Esregim that the Mizbeach was no longer Ravua. So the Mizbeach became Pasal, the Mishnah says, Rogmo, Kalam, Esregim. They threw all the Esregim at the Kohen Gadol because he was Mevaza, he wasn't the Kaim the Mitzvah. Rav Soloveitchik said, the simple pshat in the Mishnah is that they physically threw the Esregim at the hit the Kohen Gadol because he wasn't following the Torah Shebaal Peh. And that's why the Mizbech became pogum. It chipped off in the corner. Rav Soloveitchik said that Darshanim in Europe used to say, Rogmu, Kodom Yesregim has another connotation, that they debated with the Kohen Gadol, if you don't accept the Torah Shebaal Peh, how do you know that you use an Esreg? Maybe it means a banana. Maybe it means an apple. Maybe it means a pear. Who knows what a priyetz other is? You have to accept the Torah Shebaal Peh. Otherwise, why? Who told you that you should use an Esreg? Because determining that it's an esrog is part of the Torah Shebaal Peh. We do a lot of things like that to emphasize that we subscribe to the Torah Shebaal Peh. When we get married, those of us who are married, so the Mishnah says that three ways to do Kiddushin. So the Rambam says, Kiddushin Kesef, we give a ring. So Shavu Kesef is also good. Not only Kesef is good, Shavu Kesef is good. So Shavu Kesef, those who remember Kiddushin on Daf Beis Amud Aleph, the first Daf, so there's a big fat tosis and a big discussion in the Rishonim. How did the Tanaim know that Shavu Kesef is also good? How did they know that Kesef is good? It's a drasha of the Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Rambam interprets based on the Gemara that Kiddush Kesef is only known through Torah Shebaal Peh. The other two forms are Kiddush and the Torah Shebichsav, and Kiddush Kesef with Torah Shebaal Peh. And it has a nafkamina halacha. Lemaisa, the Rambam interpreted the Gemara. The Gemara says, nafkina rabbanu l'kiddush minei. So the Gemara says, that's only understandable by Kiddush Kesef, tenaf the Kodesh Bekaspa. So the Rambam said, the Kesef Mishnah says, the Rambam understood that Gemara, like the Rabbis of Shal Rashi, Tainat Kodesh Bekasp, because the whole institution of Kiddush Kesef is only Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Rambam writes, Kiddush Kesef is only Torah Shebaal Peh, and nonetheless, Kvanog and Kol Yisrael, the Kaddish Bekesef. The meaning by the Jews is, Kvanog and Kol Yisrael, the Kaddish Bekesef. What do you mean? He's talking to the Jews. The non-Jews are reading the Mishnah Torah. What do you mean? Kvanog and Kol Yisrael, the Kaddish Bekesef means the rabbinic Jews, the Karaim, the Karaites, never accepted Kiddush Kesef. There are three groups of Karoim until the Second World War. There used to be Karoim in Europe. Now there's hardly any Karoim in Eretz Yisrael. There were Karoim in Europe, in Asia, and in Africa. And each group had different shtick. And one of the things that all three had in common was that none of them had Kiddush Kesef. So the Rambam writes, Kvanog Kol Yisrael, the rabbinic Jews, those who follow the Torah Shebaal Peh, the meaning is that we choose to do Kiddush Kesef to demonstrate that we subscribe to the Torah Shebaal Peh. We don't want to use the other two forms of Kiddush. We want to demonstrate at the time that we get married, we subscribe to the Torah Shebaal Peh. The Rambam has such an expression also by Bris Milo. The Rambam says one can fulfill the mitzvah of Bris Milo by using anything that's sharp that can cut. You can use a knife, you can use a scissors, you can use a blade of grass, a piece of glass, a sharp piece of metal, any material you want, as long as it's able to cut. Then the Rambam says, and the minig is that we use a knife. Why do you use a knife? Wouldn't it make some more sense to use a scissors? You're cutting around in a circle. Why do you use a knife? I remember once a moel came to the kollel to demonstrate. He showed us a video of someone doing a bris milah, and he was explaining why he thinks the moel was doing wrong. He didn't like the way some of the moelim practiced bris milah. So he was showing a video, and then he doesn't understand why he used a knife. Why didn't he use the scissors? So that's what the Rambam talks about that. The practice by the Karoim was that they insisted on using the scissors. Because in Sefer Yoshua, it says that during the 40 years in the Midbar, traveling in the Midbar, the weather conditions were such that it was slightly dangerous to perform a bris milah. So most of Klal Yisrael didn't perform Bris Milah. Only Shevet Levi performed Bris Chiyinsaru. Shevet Levi observed Bris Milah all the years. They weren't nervous. And the rest of the Shvatim were nervous. The suffix Hakon was nowhere near 50-50. So the din is that depends on the one who's in charge of the health of the child. Depends on the patient, if the patient is nervous. The patient is 8 days old, so he's not shaykh that he should be nervous about anything. So it depends on the parents. And most of the Shvatim were nervous, because there was a slight suffix sakana in performing the bris milah because of the weather conditions in the Midbar for the 40 years. Winds were blowing in the wrong direction. And Shevet Levi was never concerned. So after 40 years of most of the Shvatim not performing bris milah, when they crossed over the Arden, the weather conditions were better. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs the Shur Benun, Kach Locha Harvos Tzuri Meshuv Moles B'nai Yisrael Sheinis. You should do a national bris milah on all the Jewish people. So what does the Lashon mean in Yosef Yeshua Harvos Tzurim? So the Karaites came up with a new interpretation. You should take two knives that cut one against the other. That's what we call scissors balaz. Take a scissors and perform bris milah. So they made up their own Torah Shebaal Peh. You can only perform a bris milah with scissors. So the Rambam says, we don't accept that. You can use scissors, you can use a knife, you can use anything that sharp and cuts. But the meaning is that we bidafka go out of our way not to use the scissors to demonstrate that we don't accept what the Karaites said. They don't accept, even when they come up with a chumrah, we don't accept it. We bedavke will not use a scissors, we'll davke use a knife, even though it makes more sense perhaps to use the scissors. No one should think that we're karoim. And the same thing, many claim that Tosis has a discussion when you light neiros on Erev Shabbos and Erev Yom Tov, whether one recites a bracha or not. So by us, it's such a double pashut. He said, are you going to bench lich? Are you going to say a bracha? And everybody knows you bench lich. Of course you say a bracha. But Taisa didn't speak Yiddish, so they didn't bench lich. So it's two opinions in Taisa. So the Gemara says that my machrainim, my mershainim is a mitzvah, my machrainim is a chayva. What does that mean, a chayva? So Taisa says one opinion, chayva means something you're obligated to do, but it's not called a mitzvah, you don't recite a bracha. So the Gemara says, that Shani Yomer, the Gemara Ben Malbikin says, Shani Yom Hadlokas Haner, Be'er Shabbos is a chayva. So Taisus has one opinion, that expression, chayva, has the connotation of something that you have to do, but you don't recite a bracha on it. And the accepted opinion is that one does recite a bracha. So Taisus says, it says in the Yerushalmi, that you recite a bracha when you light the Neiris Haner of Shabbos. There is no such Yerushalmi. The Achranim said there is no such Yerushalmi. So what did Taisus say, Yerushalmi? So some suggest that Taisus every so often will call something Yerushalmi if it's some rabbinic source other than the Bavli. Sometimes it's a Medrash, sometimes Chuvus Hagoyim, they'll call everything else with one name, Yerushalmi, some other source. So some history books claim that the Bracha on Hadlokas HaNeris was instituted in the days of the Gaonim when they were fighting against the Karoim. The Karoim mistranslated the Pasuk. So we understand it to mean you're not allowed to turn on the lights on Shabbos. You're not allowed to throw paper in the fire. Not only you're not allowed to strike a match, even if there is a fire, you're going to throw in some fuel. So you're going to cause something new to get burned. That's a malach of havor. So the Karaites interpret, you're not allowed to leave on any lights in the house. So they would always sit in the dark. On Friday night, it would be dark in the home of the Karoim. So on Shabbos morning, they would always eat cold food. So that's why Friday night they had warm food, they had heated it up on Erev Shabbos, then they would eat the meal, it would still be warm. Shabbos morning wasn't shayach, the food will always be cold. So that's why in the days of the Goyim, they instituted that you should dafke say a bracha on Hadlokas HaNeris, to demonstrate we don't accept anything the Karaites say. We say not only is it permissible to light Neris on Erev Shabbos, it's a mitzvah, and you should say a bracha. Other Rishonim say, why should you say a bracha? It's one of the preparations, one of the many preparations that you do for Shabbos. You take a shower, you set the table, you vacuum the rug, you put up the chalant, you do a lot of hachonis l'kavod Shabbos. You don't say a bracha on all the other hachonis. Why should Hadlokas HaNeris be different? So Tosfos gives an answer that's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, that Hadlokas HaNeris was a special takana midrabbanan, even if the room is lit up. Even let's say if the lights are on in the dining room where you plan to eat on Friday night, the Takanas Chachamim requires you should turn out the lights and light the candles and turn on the lights L'Shem Shabbos, and then you say a bracha. Even though let's say if someone the elves came and they vacuumed the rug. So is there a mitzvah to throw dirt on the rug and to vacuum the rug again yourself? Someone brought from a kosher store, they brought already made, chalant, everything already made, they put it, is there a mitzvah? I should give it back to the store, and I should prepare myself. If it's there, it's there already. Someone else came, the elves came, and they set the table. So is there a mitzvah to undo the table and set it again? You don't have to. But by Hadlokas HaNeris, even if the lights are on in the dining room, you should turn off the lights and light the candles, L'Shem Shabbos, and turn on the lights again, and then say the bracha. You should say the bracha on Hadlokas HaNeris, L'Shem Shabbos. That's what's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. They quote that from the Rabbi Natan in the Tosfos. That's why the Chachamim made a special takana. But others say, no, it wasn't a takana. It was instituted in the days of the Goyim, because the Goyim were fighting the Karaites, and the Karaim used to sit in the dark. So the Chachamim wanted everybody to realize whatever the Karaim say is wrong. Torah Shabbat Peh interprets the Pasuk correctly. Savar Esh B'chom Esh V'sechem does mean you have to sit in the dark. And the same thing, you have to eat warm food on Shabbos in the daytime. In Shulchan Aruch, they quote, and Morgan Avram quotes the Baal Hamor, who writes, whoever doesn't eat Chameh B'Shabbos, whoever doesn't eat some warm food on Shabbos morning, Tzorach B'dika Achrov, you have to check, maybe he's from the Kata Karai, maybe he follows Karai, so say you're not allowed to leave any fires on Shabbos. You have to demonstrate that you subscribe to the Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh is what has kept the Jewish people as the Am HaNivchar all these years. The original plan was, the Beis HaLevi has a whole essay about this, the end of the second Chelik, he has a few drushes, so he has one long drush about this. The original plan at Maimon Hasina was going to be, that the whole Torah was going to be inscribed on the Aseres, on the Luchas. Everything was going to be written on the Luchas. There wasn't going to be any need for any Torah Shabbat. Then after the Chet HaEgel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was geyser a punishment on the Jewish people, that the Ummah Olam should be able to be sholeit on the Jews. They'll be able to dominate over the Jews and unfortunately harm the Jews and kill the Jews. So they're going to have shlita on the Torah as well. So the Medrash says the Ummah Olam will come up with a new Ein Father. They're going to say that the Jews lost their status as the Am HaNivchar, and they are the Am HaNivchar. That's what the Christians were claiming for many, many centuries. They said they're the Am HaNivchar, and we lost our status because we rejected Osa Huish. We didn't accept Osa Huish. So the Medrash says, commenting on the Pasuk, in Novi Echtav La Ruba Tarase Halok Marzan Echshavu, the Gemara in Gittin quotes that Pasuk. In Daf Nun Tes, middle of the discussion whether Rav Torah is Bichsav or Rav Torah is Baal Peh. So the Pasuk, the way the Medrash interprets the Pasuk, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if it's only going to be Torah Shebichsav, the Ummah Olam have shlita over the Jewish people, will have shlita over the Torah. They're going to be able to say that they are the Yama Nivchar. So the Rebbeinu Shlom said, when he decided he has to punish the Jewish people because of the Chet HaEgel, he said, the Ummah Olam will have shlita over the Jews. So he, from now on, he's not going to have all the Torah engraved on the Luchas. There's going to be a Torah Shebichsav and a Torah Shebapeh. So when Moshe Rabbeinu came down on Yom Kippur with the Luchas Shniyos, Luchas Shniyos only had the Aseres Hadibros written on. The Luchas Rishonis had Kol HaTorah Kula engraved. That's how the Beis HaLevi quotes Gemaras and Midrashim and passages from the Zohar. Everything was Torah Shebichsav. But when Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the second set of Luchas on Yom Kippur, so only the Aseres Hadibros was there, and there was going to be the rest of the Torah Moshe Rabbeinu is going to write. And there's going to be a whole Torah Shabbat Peh that we have to be careful not to give over to the Ummah Olam. That's what indicates the uniqueness of the Jewish people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Echta la ruba tarasif, I'll write the whole Torah b'chsav, the Jews will be kamo zanech shabbat. The Ummah Olam will say, the Catholics will say that they are the Yama Nivcha. So we have the Torah Shabbat Peh that singles us out. We are the Yama Nivcha. Unfortunately, the art scroll had a standing order that every time they put out a Gemara, so they have to send 18 copies to the Vatican. They were giving the Torah Shabbat Peh to the Ummah Olam. They have no choice. They're going to say, we're not going to sell it till they go up to a bookstore and they'll buy it. It's available in all the bookstores. I'm not faulting them, but it's a problem. We're not supposed to reveal. The Torah Shabbat Peh is supposed to be reserved for the Jewish people. You're not supposed to reveal it to the Ummah Olam. Shelo yigalu es hasod. That was a problem. They tell the story that once they asked the Chazon Ish on different occasions, they would ask the Chazon Ish different shailas, and he would give a psak. So they would ask him, Vushteit, where does it say that? So he would point to his heart. Libi oimali. A person, Rashi and Chumash writes that in one place. Rashi writes about the Big Day Kuhuna. What did the Big Day Kuhuna look like? So Rashi writes in one place, Libi oimali, that looks like this and this. So the Belta is Takasha. How can Rashi say Libi oimali? The Pasuk says in Kriyashma, V'loisa surach re'elav avchem. Not supposed to follow your heart. It's a joke. It's a Yiddish folklore. Okay. L'surach re'elav avchem means not to worship Avodah Zarah. But that's in Yiddish, they ask like that. So the answer is, one who has fulfilled the Pasuk, Kosfem Aluach Libecho, Pasuk says in Mishle, you should engrave the Torah on your heart. Rashi had the Kol HaTorah Kula on his heart. So he says, Libi Aymali, that's okay. Because he fulfilled the Pasuk, Kosfem Aluach Libecho. So a lot of times, the Psak of the Talmud Chacham is based on Libi Aymali. He doesn't have a Beferish Araya from the Tanakh, or from the Gemara, from the Midrashim. Based on his understanding of Kol HaTorah Kula, he has an intuition that this is the din. There is a book in Hebrew that's called Chut HaMeshulash. It's about the three Gedolei Torah, about Rabbi Akiva Eger, who was the Chassam Sofer's first wife passed away, and his second wife was the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eger. Then she passed away. He married a third wife after she passed away. So this book, Chut HaMeshulash, is a biography of Rabbi Akiva Eger and his son-in-law, the Chassam Sofer, and his son, the Ksav Sofer, who took over the Rabbanus in Pressburg when the father passed away. And the book was written by one of the sons of the Ksav Sofer. So he has all the stories from the family. So one of the stories he has about the Chassam Sofer is that the Chassam Sofer used to, people sent him shilas from all over Europe, different communities, so he would write the tshuva, he would leave it on the dining room table, and he would ask his son, the Chassam Sofer, he should mail it. So he assumed that the son would read the tshuva before he mailed it. So sometimes his son was not happy with the tshuva, and he wouldn't mail it, he would leave it on the table for a couple of days, and the father would ask him, how come you didn't mail it? So he didn't have the chutzpah to confront his father on his own, so he would wait till the father would ask, how come you didn't mail it? He would say he didn't agree with a certain point there. So sometimes Chassam Sofer would rewrite the tshuva, he would touch it up a little bit. So on one occasion, the son didn't mail the tshuva, so the father asked him, how come you didn't mail it? So he said, the one who sent the shaila was a big Talmid Chacham. And you just write a shvacha tshuva. You think the din is like this. You didn't bring any rayas. The one who sent you the shaila knows how to learn. Bring him some rayas, not just to say, I think the din is like this. So the Chassam Sofer said that by big Talmid Chachamim, Rav Soloveitchik said the same, without the story from the Chassam Sofer. He said, by big Talmid Chachamim, you're going to say him as Eis HaBrocha, Torah Tzivolana Moshe, my Rosha Kihilas Yaakov. So my Rosha means, it's a Yerusha, the Jewish people has a Yerusha of the whole Torah. So the Gemara has an additional level of interpretation, my Rosha has the connotation of Mi'u Rosa. Every Jewish person has Erisin with the Torah. But there are two parts to marriage. When you stand under the chuppah, first, you give a ring to the Kali, say, Harem Mekudesh Hisli, so that's Kiddushin, that's Erisin. And then, you have Nisuin, you say the Shevet Brochus, then you have Nisuin. In the days of the Tanoim, in the days of the Tanakh, until the days of the Goinim, there'd be a long wait, a long pause between the Erisin and the Nisuin, sometimes up till 12 months. That's where the Yiddish expression comes from, Senemta Mayorin Amitvach. It takes them a year and a Wednesday, because the opening Mishnah in Ksuba says that Psul and Nisus, Liom Ravi, after the 12 months are up, he had the chassan has until the following Wednesday to marry the girl. So sometimes it takes him a year and a Wednesday till he gets married to the girl. So Chassam Sofer said, Rav Soloveitchik gathered this part, that every Jewish man has erisin with the Torah, and some big Talmid Chachamim have even nisuin. What's the difference between erisin and nisuin? Nisuin, the couple is already living together. So after a long while of living together, they know each other so well, they can predict already in advance what the reaction of the spouse will be to any issue that comes up. They already know each other very well. They can intuitively tell what the reaction will be. Erisin, they're married, that's all, but they're not living together. The girl is living with her parents and the boy is living with his parents. And soon they're living together. So that's what Rav Soloveitchik said, that big outstanding Talmid Chacham have not only erisin with the Torah, they have nisuin. They can tell intuitively what they think the din is. So that's where Rav Soloveitchik thought that the big Talmid Chacham, when you ask him a shaila, their psak is not that they look through the Gemara and they figure out what the din is. They have an intuition what they think the din is, and then they check in the Gemara to see that there's no contradiction to their intuition. It's not that they have to work out the shaila anew. So that's what the Chassam Sofer told his son. He said, I don't have to have any rise from the Gemara. He said, in every generation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives the koyach ha-psak to one Talmid Chacham, and he thought that in his generation he had that koyach ha-psak. And he says, the main koyach ha-psak is based on intuition. I don't have to bring any rayas. That's what Rav Soloveitchik said. I remember one occasion when Rav Soloveitchik was already sick at the end of his life, so the Rabbonim couldn't ask him any shailas. So one of the Rabbonim from the Kashrus Commission of the Rabbinical Council of America called me on the phone. He told me a shaila. What do I say about the shaila and Kashrus? I said, I don't know. I have to look it up. So he said, but before you look it up, what do you say? I said, I don't know, I have to look it up. But before you look it up, what do you think this? I don't know. So he said, but when he used to ask the Rav, when he used to ask Rav Soloveitchik, he would always say, what is intuition? I said, I'm not Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik had this intuition. He felt the name Koyach HaPsak was based on his intuition. He didn't have to look it up. He had a feeling it does fit in or it doesn't fit in with the rest of the Torah. I didn't know so much learning. I can't paskin based on my intuition. But that's the Koyach of Torah Shabbat Per. Rav Aaron Kotler has such an essay also. There's a Rosh in one place where the Rosh quotes the Ravid, I think it's in Ksubas. The Rosh quotes the Ravid. The Ravid brings a Rai from a Gemara to a certain din. So the Rosh thinks that the Rai is not a good Rai. But then the Rosh thinks that the din is like the Ravid anyway, because that makes more sense. So Baron Kotler wrote an essay, must have delivered it as a talk, and then someone wrote it up later on, that the Ravid brought a Rai from one Gemara. So it's only a Rai from one Gemara. The Rosh is saying, this is my feeling. He's bringing a Rai from Kol HaShas Kulay, from Kol HaTorah Kulay. This is his intuition. He has the feeling that this is, you don't need any Rais. But the Rosh argued that this is his feeling that's stronger than the one Rai, even if the Ravid's Rai would have been a good Rai. The Rosh thought that it wasn't such a good Rai. Even if it would have been a good Rai, it's only a Rai from one Gemara. Whereas if the Talmud Chacham says intuitively, he feels this is a din, that's even stronger. Most of the deviants over all the generations in the days of the Bais Sheni, there were periods of time that the Beis HaMikdash was being run by the Tzedukim who didn't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh. And they were observing Shavuos on a Sunday for years. And they were doing Ktziras HaYomer always on Matzoy Shabbos. And they were doing the Akrovos HaKorbanos on Yom Kippur Shaloi Kedin. So then when the Chachamim took over, so they made a Yontif, when it was Itoikim Chagad Shavuayah, when they established the Yontif of Shavuos properly, when they kicked out the Tztukim from the Bez Nagodol. There were years that the Bais Sheni was being run by the Tztukim. Then there were years that the Karoyim were tumbling for years in Europe, different groups of Karoyim. Now, there are hardly any years. Those who are religious follow the Torah Shebaal Peh. Very few only follow the Torah Shebichsav. The whole attitude that if a Talmud Chacham gives a psak and yes, kavu shteit, where does it say it? And the Chazon Ish points to his heart, his heart tells him. The whole question, what do you mean, everything has to say somewhere in a sefer? That's the koyach of the Torah Shebaal Peh. If you're asking an honest to goodness Talmud Chacham, he has nisuin with the Torah. So he knows intuitively what the din is going to be. So this is what we have, a masorah. There's no masorah on Torah Shebichsav. We call it masorah to know Yeshem la masorah. What's the text of the Chumash? We call that a masorah. But the Ikert, Moshe Tibkom, Moshe Kibbutz Torah Mesir Masorah LeYeshua, the Messiah of the Torah goes mainly on the Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh was transmitted from generation to generation. They were giving over a Masorah of Halachas L'Moshe Mi-Sinai and attitudes, what is acceptable. Not every Kasha is a Kasha. Not every Teretz is a Teretz. You have to have a tradition how to ask a Kasha and how to formulate a Teretz. I remember Rabbi Gorelick was telling us that he was one of the few who was zeichet to learn by Rav Elbele Soloveitchik in Europe. Rav Elbele had 11 empty seats on his table, so he allowed 11 students from different yeshivas to come and learn by Rav Elbele. So he was one of those lucky winners that he learned by Rav Elbele, so he felt he knows how to learn a little bit. He was chosen. So he said, Rav Elbele gave a shiur, he asked the kasha in the middle. Rav Elbele just ignored him completely. He looked at him, he didn't answer the question. And he felt insulted. What's wrong with my kasha? And after a couple of weeks, he finally realized he's on a different wavelength. He didn't understand what Rav Elbele was talking about. He totally misunderstood it. You have to have a tradition how to ask a kasha. You have to have a tradition how to give a teretz. You can't just shoot off on the top of your head whatever occurs to you at the time. You have traditions of attitudes. What's an acceptable drasha of the Torah Shebaal Peh? What's not acceptable? It has to fit in with the rest of the Torah. We live in a generation. Rabbanim are printing Shadas of Tshuvas and make up ridiculous Tshuvas. There's no contradiction to it. They're reinterpreting everything in the Shulchan Aruch. But they're reinterpreting. They have no tradition on this. You have to have a tradition. How to write a Tshuva. Not everyone who prints a Shadas of Tshuvas is entitled to an opinion. So that's the need for Masur. So that's what Hillel says in Mani Khan, Akol Khan. If I'm the chief rabbi, Hillel was the chief rabbi 100 years before the Churban Abayi, says, Amani Khan, if I'm the chief rabbi, things are okay. Then the korbanos are going to be brought properly, there's going to be Nisach HaMayim, and there's going to be Arov Al HaMizbech. I'm going to have all the Hachalachas L'Moshe Mishina. Amen, Anikal. We're going to have a different chief rabbi. He may have some apikoros. During the Bais Sheni period, they had a lot of trouble from a lot of tzukim. So, Mikan, you have to make sure that the rabbonim should be people who have strong masoira, strong traditions in Torah Shebaal Peh, and they should have, sometimes you can't always have intuition, they should have, based on a lot of knowledge, they should be able to paskin sometimes based on intuition. And that's what masoira is all about. So that's what we celebrate on Simchas Beis HaShoeva, on Sukkot. We celebrate the observance of all of the Torah Shebaal Peh that was involved in Sukkot. You have, and Sukkot, you have a lot of halachas l'moshe Mesina. Gurachas, gurasik, Lavud, Doifen Akuma, the size of the sukkah, Vav Avav, Zayin Al Zayin, Priyat Sadr, how do you know that it's an Esrog, and so on. Many halach is based on Torah Shebal Peh, and many of them are halach al-Moshe Mishina. So we should celebrate sukkahs for many years, based on all the traditions of the Torah Shebal Peh. Okay, again, I apologize, I have to run to my children in New Jersey. Good night, everyone. Have a good Niyantav.
Thank Rav Schechter for taking out his time. It's really a tremendous kavod for our shul to host this gathering, a Leil Hoshana Rabbah of Torah learning. And we're moving on to our next phase, which is going to be a panel discussion together with communal Rabbonim, Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, Rabbi Isaac Rice, and Rabbi Shai Schechter, who are going to be sharing with us, addressing various shilas that have been presented to them over the course of the recent weeks leading into Yontif. And we want to again thank the Schreier family for sponsoring this night of learning in memory of the first yard site of Mr. Tully Auerbach, Yeshaya Naftali Hertz, Ben Moshe Aram.
So thank you, everybody. It's always a pleasure to learn Torah together. And it's a great kavod to have my father here, as I mentioned before. We feel, as so many other Talmidim feel, that the greatest expression and the greatest appreciation for Mesorah is in the ongoing relationship that we have with our Rabbein. And when we were discussing over the last couple of days, what should we actually talk about at this panel, it was quite obvious that what would be most expressive of how precious our Mesorah is to talk about some of the shadows that came up over the last couple of days of Yontif. We live in a very robust community. So many different circumstances come up. So many different questions arise every Yontif and every day. And we feel very blessed that all of us have the opportunity to speak to each other, and to speak to our Rabbein while we have questions that we are confronted with. So we thought that this evening would be interesting, would be a good learning opportunity. Maybe some of these questions are relevant to you. Maybe some of the people who ask them are actually in the audience as well. And we're here really, it's not to be a shiur, it's just to have a discussion in halacha about some of the things that we have been working on over the last couple of days, and just to give everyone a little bit of a taste of that. So maybe we'll begin with one of the very interesting issues that we were all discussing together this week. Was there were many members of our community, collectively, all of our shuls, that people who were going to Eretz Yisrael after the first days of the Yom Tov. Now, the way the timing works out, when you land in Eretz Yisrael at this time of year, it's very close to the Shkia. Obviously, as we know, you have an obligation to shake the Dalaminim every day of Sukkot. And the problem is that by the time one would get through border control and customs, you would not have enough time to shake Dalaminim on the other end. So you have to take a Dalaminim with you on the plane in order to have the opportunity to shake it. The problem is that customs and border control in Eretz Yisrael has said from the outset that they were going to confiscate any of the lulavim and hadassim and arabas that were coming into the country. So the problem is, although I can shake it on the plane once it's daylight, once it's daytime, and be mekayem my mitzvah, if by bringing my lulav and esrog on the plane with me, I know from the outset that I'm now going to give over my lulav and esrog to the officials when I get there, and the customs and border control informed us that they don't just confiscate it, they burn it. Which is standard protocol. It's not that they have anything against the lulav and esrog. It's just standard protocol when somebody brings something into a country that's not supposed to be there, they burn it. So the question is, am I allowed to bring my dalaminim on the plane in order to be mekayem my mitzvah when I know from the outset that I'm not going to actually be able to keep it, and not just I won't be able to keep it, but it is now going to be burnt on Sukkot itself while it's still able to be used for its mitzvah. Is that something that is advisable? Should I just be mevatel the mitzvah of Dalet Minim for that day? What are the options? What are we supposed to do? So this was something all of us were discussing over the course of the week. We had an opportunity to talk to a number of our rabbis about it, and I don't remember exactly who prepared the question, but...
First of all, it was really great news to hear that Shaf is not staying. Very, very relieved about that. Rav Shechter has an expression that he likes to say that Amei Haaretz Eimas Shabbos Aleihem. And the Gemara says that Amei Haaretz are fearful of Shabbos, that even if they're not so careful about certain dinim, trumas and mitzvos during the week, on Shabbos they take things more seriously. So he says that as a melitza nowadays, that Amei Haaretz are afraid of Shabbos because of the way that we figure out halacha is by Googling things. And when it's Shabbos and you can't Google anything, so you're sort of stuck. So many of these shaylas that we're discussing are shaylas that came up over Yom Tov, which is, as an Amoritz, I can tell you, Emas Yom Tov Alai, Emas Shabbos Alai, that I don't have the ability to consult, to ask our Rebbein. But this shayla I thought was a very fascinating shayla. So sometimes you have to, when you get a shayla, you have to think for a second. Is the shayla that's presented, is everything true that's being presented? Sometimes you have to like take a step back, and instead of answering the question, you have to question the question. Right? Meaning, people have been traveling to Eretz Yisrael for decades. Did they change the policy? The agricultural department in Israel? Was it just that something is so late in the year that Shkia is earlier? How did this not come up before? Lamashal, I got a shayla last week, someone said to me that a woman she's home in Montreal. She normally lives during the year. She's in medical school. She's in New York, but she's in Montreal now. And she's a married woman, and she needs to get a haircut because she has very, very curly hair and can't fit under her shekel unless she gets a haircut. And the only place that's equipped to cut her very out of control curly hair is in Montreal. So can she get a haircut in Chalamoy? She's not going to be back in Montreal until Hanukkah. So, okay, you can start talking about Davra Aved and this and that and sort of come up. Or you could say, really, there's no one with curly hair outside of Montreal? Meaning, like, you take a step back and you ask, is that true? So, let's take, and yeah, if I recall, this show was asked from a chapter, from Shai Shachter, and it was asked by someone who would know, right? Someone who has some good authority, but that's the case. So one of the first things that comes to mind is Rav Shechter writes in Eretz Tzvi, he has a beautiful piece on the difference between Tashmishe Mitzvah and Tashmishe Kedusha. And although there are very strict halachas about what you're allowed to do with Tashmishe Kedusha and how Tashmishe Kedusha are mikanazim, the Gemara says that examples of Tashmishe Kedusha, Sifrei Torah, Tzolim, and Mezuzos, and things like that, Tashmishe Mitzvah are Mizrachim. You're allowed to discard Tashmishe Mitzvah and be paskin that it has to be done with Darach Kavod. But here's the problem. The problem is that it's Mizrachim, but it's only Mizrachim li achar zman mitzvah, once the zman mitzvah is over. Over here, it's still the zman mitzvah. So here you have Tashmishe mitzvah, and it's still the zman mitzvah, and you're not allowed to... It, granted that burning it is not considered Darach Kizayim, it's not considered a disrespectful way of discarding something, but you're not allowed to discard a mitzvah while it's Tashmishe mitzvah, while it's still during the time of the mitzvah. So that's what makes this a little more tricky. It also brought to mind Rav Moshe has a tshuva written to Rav Huttner, where Rav Moshe discusses a case where someone had some sort of very communicable disease, and they had to be quarantined, like a heavy quarantine, where they were told that when they're in bidud, whatever is brought into bidud with them is going to have to be burnt, it's going to have to be destroyed. And they wanted to know, are they allowed to bring their tefillin in with them? They're not going to be the ones burning it, someone else is going to burn it, but if they don't bring it with them for the next couple of weeks, they're not going to be able to be yotzei the mitzvah of tefillin. So it's a similar kind of thing, because I'm not going to be burning the lulav, I'm going to give it to the nice customs official, they're going to burn the lulav. So it brought to mind that tshuva, but it's not really a match, right? Because Rav Moshe was talking about Tashmishe Kedusha, and this is Tashmishe Mitzvah. It's also not a match, because Rav Moshe was talking about having a non-Jew burn it. You're going to give it to a customs official, it's very likely that a Jew will burn it. So if Rav Moshe is talking about, is it a violation of destroying Tashmishi Kedusha, either direct destruction or Quran, indirectly causing destruction. Over here you have an additional element that if it's Asur to do, it's also the Pei there, because it's very likely that a Jew is the one that's doing it. So I think, thank God, we were able to bring up the Shaila to Rosh Hashanah. I think Rosh Hashanah was made for in the end, because the Gemara says that if a person designates seven separate lulavim and esrogim, so it talks about esrogim, but the same is true for lulavim, for the 7 days of Yom Tov, so once that day is over, if you only designated initially, that's only going to be used that day, once that day is over, so it's no longer hooked to the mitzvah, so it's no longer considered a chetzah shel mitzvah. Oh, so then, once it's no longer a chetzah shel mitzvah, how do we all get rid of our lulav eventually? You save it to Erev Pesach and you burn it, right? That's after the month mitzvah. So then you're allowed to burn it. So that would, l'chora, take away all of the shaylas, and therefore, I think Rav Shach thought that they were allowed to bring them with them. I don't know how long to that question. I'll be stopping. How do you think this?
Okay, good morning, everyone. I guess I'll pick up another shayla that came up. This is something that does come around from year to year. And that has to do with leaving Eretz Yisrael on Yom Tov Sheni. We, Baruch Hashem, live in a time where we have a tremendous luxury to be able to travel back and forth from America to New York, back to Tel Aviv, whenever we want, so that's a drop in the hat. And the question comes up for, we're going to assume something for a moment, that a person, a Ben Chutz La'aretz, is going to be keeping one day of Yom Tov in Eretz Yisrael. Let's just assume that to be the proper thing for a moment. So can that individual now get on a plane on what is essentially Yom Tov Sheni for Bnei Chutz La'aretz and now fly back to America? We're timing it to land essentially by both say Yom Tov here in America. We've had this before. I've had students arrive in SKA the day after Yom Tov was over, miraculously from Eretz Yisrael. And I was told that they got on a plane and traveled back to America. I know that some of the Rabbanim here have also had such an experience. And the question is that allowed? Is that appropriate? So the first thing is just a bit of background. We know that the Maram Satan says that a Ben Chutz La'aretz, a Ben Eretz Yisrael, a person who lives in Eretz Yisrael who finds themselves in the Chutz La'aretz, they have to keep the Chumra of where you go and where you come from. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch says very clearly that a Ben Eretz Yisrael who finds themselves in Chutz La'aretz has to keep the chumras of the Melech, and the public is not allowed to make a Chal Shabbos Mechal Yom Tov over the course of the Yom Tov. Now, unfortunately, or for a lack of clarity, Shulchan Aruch doesn't talk about the other direction. What do you do when a person is coming from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael? However, he does talk about it, just not in the book of Shulchan Aruch. We know that Yosef Karo writes in his Shuvas Ab Kisrael clearly that the minhag in his time and the minhag before his time was that a Jew from outside the land of Israel who comes to Eretz Yisrael has to keep 2 days in Eretz Yisrael. He's unequivocal, it's very clear, without question. The Shabura says the same thing as well in Hilchos Gatzef, that a person should keep 2 days when they go to Eretz Yisrael. We are all familiar in this day and age by 2022. You might not know any other Shuvas from the Chacham Tzvi. We might not even know who the Chacham Tzvi was. We don't know if he lived before or after Rashi, before or after Chazmish, but we all know one Shulchan from the Chacham Tzvi. So we all know the Chacham Tzvi says that you're supposed to keep one day in Eretz Yisrael. This doesn't depend on the minute of who you are, where you come from, but you live inside or outside of Eretz Yisrael. Chacham Tzvi says it depends on where you are. And the minute in Eretz Yisrael is to keep one day, so someone who lives should keep one day. Chacham Tzvi is pretty much, not totally, but alone in that opinion. The Baal Sherebi agreed, the Baal Tanya agreed as well. There apparently was a change in the minhag over the last 2 decades. When I was younger, not so old, I'm looking around the room, there's other people who are older than me, there's other people younger than me also, there's other people older than me. When I was younger, most Jews who went to Eretz Yisrael for Yom Tov kept 2 days. There was a minority of Jews who kept 1 day. They were the odd man out. But most Jews kept 2 days. There apparently was a sea change in the last 2 decades, moving from most Jews keeping 1 day instead of 2 days. Some Jews had shilas. I have a feeling that many people maybe didn't have some shilas, not sure. But apparently there was a change. So the question is, Now, when a person gets on a plane, and they leave the, let's assume that we're in the Pasimai Kefachan state, and those people have much relying on to keep one day. When a person leaves the borders of Eretz Yisrael, the plane flies over, and now enters Swiss Arts, does Yatzim change for them in the middle? I mean, it wasn't Yatzim, and now all of a sudden, in a place where it is Yatzim, from the Kosar, it doesn't change. So Rabbi Rachmiel Fried, the author of Yatzim Shem Kefachasa, says 100% it does, because the halacha is the other way. If you are in Eretz Yisrael, on what is Yom Tov, and you decide in the middle of Yom Tov to make Aliyah right then and there, Rabbi Fried says that you don't have to keep 2 days anymore. Changes smack in the middle of Yom Tov, your status can change right in the middle. So he says that technically it should go the other way as well. When you're leaving Eretz Yisrael, it should become a Yom Tov for you once you leave the borders of Eretz Yisrael, and it becomes a Yom Tov. Rav Moshe writes in the Shuvas that it's a problematic to go on a plane, just like it's problematic to go on a boat. That's when you travel on Shabbos, not talking about cruise ships, but on a boat. You know, to go on a plane on Shabbos is problematic as well. There's all types of issues that arise the second you're on a plane, and it becomes dangerous. There's electricity everywhere. I mean, you can't touch any, use any of the lights, you can't use any electronics, you can't go to the bathroom on the plane. I mean, technically, if you could hold it in, that would be fine, but you can't lock the door, everything is electronic. So over the course of that flight, it automatically becomes yantif for those people who are flying. Rav David Weiss, who is the dayan in Antwerp, writes in the Shulchan Aruch Dayan Davin Chayavas that you can't leave, unless you're a full ben Eretz Yisrael. But if you're a ben Chos Laaretz who's relying on Chacham Tzvi, the minute you leave the airspace of Eretz Yisrael, it becomes yantif and becomes problematic as well. What are those people relying on? They're probably relying on a tshuva of Mordechai Eliyahu. Mordechai Eliyahu has a tshuva to Rav Pinchas Toledano, who is a rabbi in Europe, where he says that if you own an apartment in Eretz Yisrael, then that is sufficient to leave the borders of Eretz Yisrael and you would remain a ben Eretz Yisrael once you leave the borders. But you have to own an apartment. Second of all, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu is assuming a sack that we generally don't assume. That owning an apartment is enough to make you into the Eretz Yisrael. Even if you go like Rosh Hashanah Arbach, you need to be there for all Shalosh Shabbat, and which is, you know, also a kula as well. And therefore, would be that certainly in our community, it would be problematic to get on a plane on Yom Tov Sheni if you're keeping one day in Eretz Yisrael, because the minute you leave the airspace, it becomes Yom Tov, and all the issues would arise.
Can I just comment on that? First of all, it's very brave of you to talk about this one. Anyone who would be upset about it is in Israel. but just a couple of, maybe one clarification. First of all, the idea that that if you decide right in the middle of Yom Tov that you're going to move, you can be better. And so I think Rav Nassim Shtetner writes in the Tshuva somewhere that he had that mice that he was learning. He came for Shavuos or something. He had such a good night of learning the first night of Shavuos. He decided he'd stay, and he didn't know what to do. So he ran over to the Chazanish, and he asked the Chazanish, like, "What do I do now? I decided to stay. I'm not going home." And he said, "Okay, so you're Ben Eretz yourself. That's it. So it could happen in the middle of the day." Also, the Rice pointed out that if you're on the plane, it becomes Yantiv on the way out of Eretz Yisrael. You have to make Kiddush. You should probably do a kafos. There's a lot of things that that are immediately okay if it becomes yantif for you. I have a very hard time understanding that tshuva from Mordechai Eliyahu. There's a very important distinction that Rabbi Rice alluded to, but maybe we could just say it more strongly. There's a big difference between a person who is a Ben Eretz Yisrael, who is always a Ben Eretz Yisrael, and when they're in Chutz Laaretz, they publicly, and perhaps according to Mishpura, privately also, observe an Issa Malacha, versus a person who's not always a Ben Eretz Yisrael. Even most of the people from our communities who observe one day of Yom Tov in Eretz Yisrael observe 2 days of Yom Tov when they're here. Right? They're not observing, they're not doing the Yom Tov happening when they're here on the second day, because they're not always a Ben Eretz Yisrael. They're following some sort of psak that says that when they're in Eretz Yisrael, they're in Ben Eretz Yisrael. When they're in Chutz Laaretz, they're in Chutz Laaretz. Rav Asher Weiss has such a psak when it comes to people who have nothing tying them to Chutz Laaretz, that they own not just own an apartment, they spend several months there, and they don't have young children in school over here. So he says, okay, so concern when you're in your home. In Yerushalayim, you're Ben Eretz Yisrael. You're in your home. In Whitmer, you're Ben Chutz La'aretz. If you're an actual Ben Eretz Yisrael who only lives in Eretz Yisrael, you're probably allowed to take such a plane. You just can't see it unless you should. You just can't come into the community until after Yatim is over. But if you're just a make-believe Ben Eretz Yisrael, you're a person who's a Ben Eretz Yisrael and you're Eretz Yisrael, and then the Chutz La'aretz and the Chutz La'aretz, that's where all the problems that Rabbi Rice mentioned come up. So my guess is that that psak is based on a confusion of those two categories of people. That people heard that there are Israelis that come back and they say, I'm an Israeli too. But, you know, but you're not. Meaning, if a person's not an Israeli, the chadra doesn't work. Is that right?
I guess I'll just comment on that. I do remember a couple of years ago that the distinction Rabbi Lewis was just making between a Ben Eretz Yisrael and a Ben Chutz La'aretz who finds himself in Eretz Yisrael. A couple of years ago, Rabbi Usher Weiss had a medical emergency with his wife, and they needed to come for medical treatment in America. Now, the emergency wasn't that they needed to get in as quickly as possible. It was within the next couple of days they needed to come in. It was Shavuos time, and I remember he flew on Yom Tov Sheni out of Eretz Yisrael together with his wife, and he landed here in America. Now, that's in line with everything that we mentioned. He lives in Eretz Yisrael, he is a Ben Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, obviously, Yom Tov Sheni did not kick in from him once he got here. However, he did stay in the airport once they landed until Yom Tov was over here, and that's what Rabbi Lewis was alluding to. You have to stay outside of the Yishuv. If you're going to stay in JFK, that's not really contingent, that's not really part of any religious community, and therefore you're not shy up to what they're doing. You're outside of the tumah, therefore it's not a problem. I do remember at the time, he had an older brother, who's a tremendous Talmud Chacham, who took issue with his younger brother flying to America on Yom Tov Sheni. I remember it was a major discussion in the car on the way back, and a big fight. And nice to hear them discussing it, but his brother said, even if Meikar Adin is mutter, and even if everything's fine, he said, you have to understand, flying into JFK, where they had Jews coming in and out all the time, and now they're just going to see Jews flying in Yom Tov Sheni, so it becomes very confusing. So he said, leaving the halacha aside, is that an appropriate thing to do, to come to fly into a community where they think they understand about Shabbos and Yom Tov, and they're very respectful of it, and all of a sudden, they're going to see Jews starting to land. It's just going to be mezalzel in the kushas, Shabbos, and Yom Tov, as far as all the people we interact with. So he just brought that up as a consideration, which is an interesting point. Even if you follow all the criteria and you stay outside of the Yishuv, is there what to be concerned about when you're dealing with other people who are going to see you doing malacha on Yom Tov Sheni? So I just thought that was an interesting addition to make as well. We know that Halachas Neiros Shabbos and Yom Tov is something that is a very important mitzvah, and it's something that we all try our best to do. It's a question of why it's something that's usually limited to the woman of the home. Obviously, if a man lives by himself, for whatever reason, he would, of course, be obligated to light Neiros Shabbos and Neiros Yom Tov. We know that when somebody forgets to light Neiros Shabbos and Yom Tov, it becomes a very traumatic event. And the question that came up over the last couple of days was, there were a group of, I think it was six women who were all together for Yom Tov, and on Yom Tov Sheni, the second night of Yom Tov, none of them remembered to light candles. And this was a big trauma. This was a major issue in the house. What are they going to do now? They remember they forgot to light Neiros Yom Tov. What do they do about it? So, this is a very important question. And the women wanted to know, do we all need to now add another candle for the rest of our lives because we all forgot to light Neiros Yom Tov on the second night of Yom Tov? And I think it's a fascinating question on two levels. So let's begin. My father often quotes from the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon writes that there are two categories of the way that we celebrate Shabbos every week. Number one is Kavod Shabbos, and then there's Onik Shabbos. What is the difference between Kavod Shabbos and Onik Shabbos? So the Vilna Gaon explains, Kavod Shabbos are all the activities that we do in preparation for Shabbos, like my father was just describing a few moments ago. Onik Shabbos is the enjoyment we get on Shabbos itself from the preparations that we may have done. So eating good food on Shabbos is part of Onik Shabbos. Cleaning the house for Shabbos is part of Kavod Shabbos. So now I ask you, now that we have these two categories of Kavod and Onik, so how would you classify, how would you categorize Hadlakas Neiros Shabbos? Is that part of Kavod Shabbos in anticipation? Or is that part of Onik Shabbos that allows us to appreciate Shabbos because now we have lights on the table? And the answer is, it's probably both, because we light candles in anticipation of Shabbos, so that's part of the preparation, it's part of Kavod. On the other hand, we enjoy the benefit of the candles on Shabbos itself, and therefore it would fall under the category of Oneg Shabbos. So the Maharil, who is the father of Chachmei Ashkenaz, the Maharil lived at the end of the 1300s, he writes that there was a minhag that developed that if a woman ever forgets to light Neiros Shabbos, so she has this knas that is imposed upon her, and from that time and forward, she then has to add an extra additional candle every time she lights Shabbos candles in the future, subsequently. So, we're familiar with that, and that became very famous. The truth is, that was actually a very controversial psak that the Maharil made. It was not so clear that he should be accepted. As we know, the reason why we light two Shabbos candles is because Zacha v'Shomer. We commemorate this dual special feeling that we have on Shabbos of Zacha v'Shomer with the word Ephedem. So a woman lights one candle to cover Shabbos as Zacha, the second candle to commemorate the Shomer. If you're going to add to that, now you're going to throw off the whole understanding of Zacha v'Shomer. Now that you have three candles, it doesn't correspond to anything. So isn't that a problem? And this is actually discussed in the Sanz Sofer and Tshuva, where he talks about sometimes we find that adding to something is not a problem at all, while other times we find that adding to something throws off the whole count. For example, let's say on Hanukkah, I'm going to say, you know, I love the Hanukkah candles so much, let me add an extra 10 candles. Obviously, it's not going to correspond to the days of Hanukkah, and then that would throw off the whole mitzvah. It wouldn't make sense to add. Take, for example, Shulchan Aruch talks about four cups of wine on Leil HaSeder. You're not allowed to add additional cups of wine. Certain times during the meal you can, but to add additional cups of wine takes away from the whole understanding of what Dalet Kosos is supposed to be commemorating. Rashi writes, the Rishbam talks about it, the Lutzesi, the Itzalfi, the Alfi, the Lakafi. There's a reason why we have the number four cups of wine on Leil HaSeder. And the question is, when do you say it's permissible to add, and when do you say it would not be appropriate? So for example, we know that we have Lechem Mishnah every Shabbos. So what if I have many guests at the table and two loaves of bread is not going to be sufficient? Can I then add an extra additional loaf of bread? Can I have many loaves of bread? Will that take away from Lechem Mishneh? So this is an interesting discussion that some server gets into it. Mafia is in front of Shofros, he quotes Igmar Rosh Hashanah. Can you add to the Pesukim there? So what's fascinating is the Maharil, which is quoted in the Rambam Shulchan Aruch, writes that we do have this idea that we impose a knas on a person who forgets to light a Shabbos candle 1 week. But the question is that really appropriate? Does that really make sense? Now today, we have the minhag, many people light candles, not just two, they light for each child, for each grandchild, so we add candles anyway. But I just find it fascinating that at the time, this was a very debatable point, and it was not so clear that it would actually be appropriate. So the Magen Avraham says, what would be a limitation of this halacha? So the Magen Avraham says, if a woman was nesa, if it wasn't her fault, say for example, one of the children gets hurt right before Shabbos, she has to run to the hospital, and as a result of that, she's unable to light the Shabbos candles. Well, obviously, that's not something she could have anticipated. It's not her fault, and therefore, because she was only in Anusa, we would not put a knas onto someone who, by no fault of their own, ended up in that situation. Be as it may, many contemporary poskim write that the only time we have this imposed knas on a woman who forgets to light Shabbos or Yom Kippur candles is only in the days when, as a result of not lighting the candles, you have no light in the house. And as a result of that, your Shabbos is miserable. You're tripping over the furniture, like the Gemara says, Mishum Shalabayis. You're just not going to have a comfortable experience of Shabbos. That's why we have this notion of making a knas on a person that from here on in, don't ever forget to light Shabbos candles again, because Shabbos was miserable when you didn't light the candles. But today, when we have electric lights on, and our Shabbos is not so negatively impacted by the fact that we don't have Shabbos candles, there are many poskim who say that as long as there are some lights on over the duration of Shabbos, and my Shabbos was very manageable and very comfortable, there are many who say that the knas would not be imposed in such a situation, which leads us to a much larger question. And I don't want to take all the time here, because we have a lot of other things to talk about, but if that's the case, why do we light Shabbos candles in the first place? If we have electric lights on, why do we need to light candles? Right? That should be a pretty important question to address. So this is something that was raised by all of you on the last generation, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Ben Yosef. Rav Soloveitchik spoke about it. And many of the Gedolim tried to figure out, well, what is the purpose? What's the reason to light Shabbos candles if, in fact, we have the electric lights on? which you need to ask yourself on Yom Hashem. On Yom Hashem, when we obviously have the lights on in our homes, what is the reason to light Yom Tov candles, and how do we do it properly to make sure that our Yom Tov candles are actually going to be meaningful? So I would say, in this situation, when a woman forgot to light Yom Tov candles, number one, it's Yom Tov Sheni, and we have electric lights on, and the woman, it's true she forgot, but they did not have a miserable Yom Tov as a result of her forgetting. I would say, because of the trauma involved in telling a woman that from here on in she has to light another candle, and if you've never spoken to anyone who has to go through that, go talk to one of the women upstairs and ask them what it feels like. So I would say that we should rely on those posting who say that this ma'azeh, when you have electric lights on and your Shabbos was very comfortable and very manageable, I would say maybe that would be something that we should advise in this situation.
I have a little parashat. First of all, Rabbi Schechter alluded to the idea that in Yom Tov Sheni, when the lights are already on, so what are you really adding when you light candles? So that's, I think, a fairly well-known shita of your father, right? That ain chinam, it's bracha l'batala and malacha for no reason. So like,
before we walk away and say Rabbi Schechter did away with Neros Shabbos and Yom Tov. First of all, this question is raised by the Gedolim of the generation. How do we deal with Yom Tov Sheni? How do we deal with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach talks about it in the Tshuva? How do we deal with Yom Tov Sheni? Why are we lighting candles? One is not just allowed to light candles on Yom Tov if there is no purpose. It's called a Ner Shel Batela. Shulchan Aruch writes clearly, not allowed to do it. Even the later Achronim, my father loves to talk about this, the later Achronim point out, even lighting a Yartzeit on Yom Tov itself is very questionable. What is the purpose of lighting it on Yom Tov? Especially today, I'm not saying the Yartzeit candle is not important, but especially today when we have two-day candles where we can light the candle before Yom Tov starts and it will last till the second day of Yom Tov when we say Iskar, who said there's a heter at all to light a Yartzeit on Yom Tov? That is a very serious question, and it's potentially a malacha d'oraisa on Yom Tov that has no heter at all to be violated. So this is a discussion, it's not that my father invented it. This is a major discussion. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, well, the truth is, the value of lighting candles is, I know I just totally stole my, literally and figuratively, so Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes that there is added value, because what would a Shabbos or Yom Tov table be without candles on the table? It just doesn't feel like Shabbos. So that is a good enough reason, the fact that we have the ambiance of Shabbos or Yom Tov with candles on the table. That's a defining characteristic of a Shabbos and Yom Tov table. And if you don't have that, there's something very much lacking in the experience of Shabbos and Yom Tov. And that is enough of a justification to allow one to do a malacha of lighting candles on Yom Tov Sheni, just to have that ambiance, which is a tremendous fiddish of Rav Shlomo Zalman. Admittedly, he writes it as a fiddish, but it's an interesting one.
I'm holding it too fancy. All I was trying to say. Is that normally people view that particular shita, not lighting on the second night, as something that's like a real hardship. You were saying, describing to someone that they're going to play an extra candle. So a lot of women are very much not in the kabbal to not light on the second night when there's a light on in the room, and they would much prefer to rely on Shlomo Zalman or Moshe Weiss, that the ambiance is added. But what Rav Shai Shachter just pointed out is that it turns out that that's also in this case, that because there's probably no real requirement to light on the second night anyway, so the whole Knas of the Mariel is not going to apply, because it could be that you didn't have to do anything anyway. So it's a nice twist on the way it normally plays out. I once saw one of the Achronim, they said that Rashad mentioned the idea of adding an extra candle with each child that's born. One of the Achronim suggested that it used to be after a woman had a child, she was so out of commission for a while that she missed the night, she missed the Lucas Neiros that week. So because she missed that week, so she it's hard to imagine if you make a knas if a woman is so out of commission.
Just want to just add one more thing about the knas. I heard a beautiful psak from Rosh Hashanah Rosh Shimon Shlav that a woman does have to suffer the knas of missing a week. That the point of the knas is not to embarrass the woman for the rest of her life. The point of the knas is a monetary knas. That because there's a lack of light for Shabbos, so it needs to make up in a monetary way. The minhag amongst Yekkis in Washington Heights is to light only two candles, only for Zachar Shomer, nothing else. So as Rav Shechter likes to say, it once happened in the history of Yankees and Washington Knights, a woman once forgot to light candles. So she came to Rav Shlach crying because she knew of the knas, but she also knew that, can you imagine being the only woman in Washington Knights lighting 3 candles for the rest of your life? It's tremendously embarrassing. So listen to the wisdom of a posek and a sensitive rub. So Rav Shlach told the woman, that's fine. So light taller candles for the rest of your life. If the candles were yay tall, so now you'll light the tall candles. And then you and Hashem will know that you once forgot. No one else will know. You'll fulfill the knas of the Maharil and the Ramah. And in the same way, you'll keep the spirit of Shabbos as well. Let's keep the minute to only have 2 candles.
So I guess we'll move on to the next shadow. So one of the shaylos that came up on Eretz that we were also discussing was that someone was wanted to host a Geirus candidate for a Yatif Miyot. You see, it's like a catch-22. It's very tricky because, as you know, anyone who's ever served on a Beis Din Giyur, you ask a lot of questions about Shas and Yantif and what the experience is like, and have you experienced the Yantif meal? Have you experienced the Seder? Have you been in the Sukkah? You know, all of these things. Yet, there's a halakha for Rashis and Shulchan Aruch that you're not allowed to invite a non-Jew for a Yantif meal. For Shas meal, yes, but for a Yantif meal, no. So the Gzeira, Shemi Yarda B'Shvila. There's a Gzeira that you might come to add and cook extra for him, and the Gemara says that even though you're allowed to do malachas of al nefesh, the pasuk is clear that it's lachem v'lo l'nachmi. You're not allowed to do malachas of al nefesh for a nachmi. So you're not allowed to cook for a nachmi. So Chazal made it say that you're not even allowed to invite the nachmi for a yontif meal because you might cook something extra for him. That was the gzeiras Chazal. So it's a real catch-22 because we're not going to even hire the person until they experience some yontif meals. But no one's allowed to invite them for a yantif meal. So what do you do in that situation? So Shabbos Kol Moed is an option, or when yantif and Shabbos coincide, that's perhaps an option. But when it comes to just yantif itself, the posts can work very hard in trying to come up with kulas. I counted, I think, 7 or 8 different suggestions. I'm not going to go through all of them now. Rav Asher Weiss has Rav Shai sent me an unpublished tshuva, so it can be a chiluk daled. So of Rav Asher Weiss, where he, I think one of the tshuvas was to Rabbi, the one from Dallas, the one that you just quoted, Rabbi Fried. Yeah. So the Rav Asher Weiss just has a ha'ara about the entire sugya. He said, if you look carefully at all the Rishonim, they all struggle with, and what about your maid? What about someone who lives in your house who's not allowed to feed them on yantif? You're not allowed to have them eat in your house on yantif? And all the Rishonim come up with different tirutzim, which what emerges is that there are a whole bunch of exceptions to the rule, that this was not a low cloak, that this gzeira was not a low cloak. So Rav Asher Weiss says, now that we know, based on the Rishonim, that the gzeira was not a low cloak, it seems that we're allowed to come up with svaras as to why this gzeira should no longer apply. And he suggests 3 or 4 different svaras. Most people cook everything before yantif anyway, because now we have modern refrigeration. It used to be they were cooking everything on the spot. Most people are not making separate dishes, they just make more of the same for the people that, you know, just svaras, why things might have changed since those times. But Gedalia Lev Schwartz had the most unusual of all of the chidushim, where he suggested that there's a tshuva in the Binyan Tzion. The Binyan Tzion discusses a case that happened in Eretz Yisrael. A ger had come from Morocco, it said. Nicole Zilberman told me that they found writings of Rabbanim in America at the time, and it seems that it was a typo. It was not Morocco, it was America. It was the ger had come from America at the time, and he was in there, so he wasn't a ger yet. He did a mila, he was converting into the Beis Din Yerushalayim. He did a mila, and he hadn't healed in time to do a tevila before Shabbos. So the shaila was, does he observe Shabbos to come? Because it's also catch-22. Gaisha Shabbos is Chayav Misa. A Jew that's not Shabbos is Chayav Misa. So what is he? He had a mila, but he didn't have is Tbilia. And if you've ever been involved and spoken to Gerus candidates, the thing they hate the most is having to be Mechal Shabbos. They can't stand it. My father-in-law is an expert on Zman, and he told me he was once traveling, and he was talking to someone in Shul, after davening, I'm sure. Not really so sure, but let's assume. And the person said to him, oh, I'm not even Jewish yet. Practice. My father-in-law said, what do you do, like, to not keep Shabbos? So the guy said, I wait till he gave a number of minutes after Shkia, and I light a match. My father-in-law said, you gotta wait a little longer, that's probably not till the Shabbos. But it's a catch 22. So in the case of the Bidin Zion, what happened was someone came to the potential Ger's home and forced them to light a match. So you're not allowed to keep Shabbos, you have to light a match right now. And they traumatized them and they forced them to light a match. So the Bidin Zion writes all the Chukwu where he says that that's a mistake. He's half Jewish. Meaning he's not fully Jewish yet. It's not like you're either a Jew or a non-Jew. There's such a thing as half Jewish, and as such, he should not have that match. It was wrong for them to force him to do that. So Rabbi Gamliel of Schwartz said, you see that in the Tahalich HaKiyur, somehow it's not like you snap your fingers and the whole status changes. That there's like a slow status change, and maybe as far as that Dindrabam is concerned. It goes away when a person is already on the path toward Gimur. It's a very difficult svara, but you get the impression that all the poskim work hard to try to come up with a svara. Lesson, I'll give the mic over in a second. Lesson known is Mishabura writes that not only is there such a gzeira for non-Jews, but even for someone who is not shown their Shabbos, there's such a gzeira that you're not supposed to invite them for a yantif meal. So that is a real problem. Right? What do you do? Everybody has, unfortunately, some family member. We're thinking about people who are Bali Tshuva, they're going to have their parents. So that all the Poskim are making with. Everyone comes up with ways to make about that much more easily than in the Kairos case.
So just to add to that, on the Erev Shabbos, I got a call from somebody who is a Rebbe in a local yeshiva, and he has a Talmud, he has a student who is a full-fledged Jew, but whose father is a non-Jew. And he said to himself, what kind of experience is this Talmud going to have at home? His father's not Jewish. Like, what kind of sickness is he going to have? He wants to invite the family to eat over on Friday night. I'm sorry, on Shmini on Saturday night. He wants to invite them over. At least they should experience Yom Tov in his home. Then he realized, oh, it's a great idea, but the problem is I just invited the whole family. The father's not Jewish. Everybody else is. So he wanted to know what he should do. So the question is there any, again, Rabbi Leibowitz just mentioned that there is room to be made even without it. The Poskim try to come up with different ideas, different solutions. But I thought maybe there was even more room to be made in this case for the following reason. The Rush writes on that Gemara, when the Gemara talks about we make Zera not to invite a non-Jew on Shabbos because we're afraid on Yantip, maybe you're going to cook for him. So the Rush writes, but if the Nachri comes on his own, meaning I didn't invite him, Eino Mazmino, he just showed up. So I don't throw him out of the house. Of course, he sits down. Why is that the case? The Rush says, because if I invite a guest, then the understanding is I'm going to provide him with the same royal treatment that I provide all the other guests. If somebody just shows up into my house uninvited, and it's just, eino mazmino, I didn't go out of my way to invite him, he just knows that I serve good meals when he comes. In that case, there's no expectation that I'm going to serve him anything more than what's on the table. And therefore, the Rush writes, this takana, this zera would not be applicable. So I thought, in this case, why am I inviting this family? I'm inviting the family because I want my Jewish Talmud to have an opportunity to experience Yom Tov. It so happens that his father's coming along also. I thought maybe that was similar to what the Rush writes, it's not that he's coming uninvited, but my point was not to invite him. My point was to invite all the Jewish members of the family. He happens to be tagging along. But that really was not my intention when I invited the family. So I ran that by my father, who in general finds this a little bit more difficult than some of the other postings. He's not so thrilled, he's not so keen about all the heter that everybody gives on this issue about inviting a non-Jew on Yom Tov. And he thought that was a very good start. He thought that it made sense, that there is more room to be made in this case than there would have been to be made in the other case. I will add to the other point you made about a non-religious family member. I did ask my father a couple of years ago that there was a family who it really would have caused tremendous shalom bias issues if this member of the family who is no longer Orthodox was not going to be invited for Yom Tov. And, you know, he wanted to be spending family time with everyone. And my father said, although the Mishnah Berurah is extremely clear about his position, and generally we follow the Mishnah Berurah on many of the issues, he said, Shalom Bayis is more important than the Mishnah Berurah Slumra. And he said that he thought Mishnah Shalom Bayis would need to be Mekel, and you cannot be Machmer from Mishnah Berurah. And you certainly should invite that non-religious family member to your home for the Yom Tov meal.
Quick comments. First of all, Rishon Zalman says exactly like you just said, with the that if you're inviting a whole group of people and you really want to invite the Jewish people, and because it comes up in Kibbutz situations a lot, you're trying to be Makari people and you have a whole group and they bring a friend, or some of the people that are in the group are not halachically Jewish, but they view themselves as Jewish or whatever, so they're coming along together. And as far as, there was another point, but as far as the non-religious Jew, I forgot what the other point was. Okay.
This is an online learning program, right?
I'll take move on to another question, and that's it. Have a gentleman in our shul who's a Baal Tshuva later in life, and his father is also a ger. So he does not have somebody to talk him or Masorah. He's kind of recreating on his own. And the question was, what should he do? He's moved to our community recently in the last couple of years. What should he do about tefillin on Chol HaMoed? He asked me, what is the minimum of the shul? And what should he do about tefillin on Chol HaMoed? So let's talk about tefillin on Chol HaMoed, and then I'll tell you what I told this gentleman. There are kama v'kama rayos and shas that one should wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. It is pretty clear to anyone who goes to the Gemaras that the opinion of the Gemara is that one wears tefillin on Chol HaMoed. It's clear it's not wearing tefillin besides Isra Malacha. There's no Isra Malacha on Chol HaMoed. You can write, the Gemara says you can write tefillin on Chol HaMoed if you need tefillin on Chol HaMoed. You can send tefillin on Tzorach Chol HaMoed on Yom Tov, says the Gemara. The Yerushalmi to ask about the Yochanan who would get headaches because he wore tefillin on Chol HaMoed. And the Gemara says they would blow shofar erev Shabbos Chol HaMoed, in order to tell people to take off their tefillin for Shabbos. So the Gemara seems to be very clear. And kemat kol chachbei Ashkenaz, all of the Ashkenaz of Gedolim, from the days, you know, from after Rashi, Rashi Shita is not clear, but from the days of Rashi until through the Ramah, wore tefillin Chol HaMoed, that's the Shita of the Ramah, and poskei Ashkenaz. However, there is a comment of the Zohar that says that very, very bad things will happen to you if you wear tefillin Chol HaMoed. Can't ignore that. The Arizal in that line as well, and because of the Arizal, the Baal Shem Tov and Chassidim felt as well that one should not wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Yes, there is the Chayyada who quotes the Gra that says the Gra does not wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, but as the host will point out, not a single soul in Vilna followed the Vilna Gaon, and he was alone in his base medrash in wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed, besides for select Talmidim. So it would seem, and this is what I generally tell people in my shul, that unless you are Sephardi and you follow Rav Yosef Karo and Shulchan Aruch, or you come from a strong line of Hasidim, Ashkenazim, wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. That would be the proper halacha. So in this individual, whose father is not Jewish and does not have a prior minhag, it's pashut that he should certainly wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, as the minhag of Ashkenazim, if I have not made that clear. Rav Yosef Afrasi writes in Shulis Isa Yosef that if someone is a Baal Tshuva and he does not come from Hasidim, he certainly must put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed, because that's a minhag of Ashkenazim. So in this case, I instruct this individual that he should certainly start wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed, as is the minhag for Ashkenazim. I'm not going to share anybody's minhag. But again, if you don't have any minhag, and Ashkenazim were
as well on I'm just in the middle, so I get comment on everything. There is a discussion about whose minhagim gerim should accept, meaning they don't have any sort of for minhagim. So some suggest, a funny suggestion, that based on where in the world they're from, they should figure out if they were Jewish, you know, what their minhagim would have been. So if the person is from a Sephardic country, even though they've been, you know, a guy for generations in their family, that they should not.
But I think the more common assumption is that who is becoming them? Which community are they going into? Meaning, if a person is becoming a Ger, then they're becoming a Chabad Chassid. So they should have Chabad. Not if a person is becoming a Ger, they're becoming a modern Orthodox person. So they should follow the modern Orthodox, not, you know, the ones that are halachically correct. It could be that would depend on Minhag Hamakom also. I don't know. I know that, like, Rabbi Rice made a very clear point about, you know, the very strong Ashkenazi Minhag. This is, like Rabbi Rice was talking about before, when you look around what the Svarim say, what people actually do, you know, sometimes you look around shuls and people that are wearing tefillin and chol-moed, they feel like they have, like, two heads, like, everyone's, like, staring at them, like, what's wrong with you? Why are you wearing tefillin and chol-moed? Most people don't even realize that that's the predominant Ashkenazi Minhag. So, I'm not questioning anything, I'm just asking, like, there is perhaps room to suggest that based on whatever the minute of the community is that they're going to be part of that.
I would say that at this point in our communities, it's hard to argue that there's a strong minhag of the community when it comes to Tfilin HaMoed. There's such a mishmash, you know, like Rosh Hashanah likes to point out that after the Holocaust, like Minhag HaMakom is kind of, you know, abandoned in many ways. Everything, and we're a big Baruch Hashem in many ways, we are, as the saying goes, a gorgeous mosaic of different people and different things. It's hard to nail down. You have to bring a very strong eye to say that there's a strict minhag, you know, at this point, you know, in most places regarding, you know, Tfilin HaMoed.
Okay, I know that many people in our community have pets, and especially during COVID, many extra people, additional people, invited pets into their homes. So actually, this year I've got two different shadows about pets. The first question was, am I allowed to cook for my pet on Yom Tov? So that's an interesting question, and the answer is very clear. The Gemara says, "Lachem lo l'klavim." The Gemara says that cooking on Yom Tov is not permissible. You're only allowed to cook on Yom Tov for people, for human beings. The Gemara says, "Be darshan from the pasuk lachem." The Lola Club, that one would not be allowed to prepare food or do a malacha on behalf of an animal. Okay, so that was pretty easy. The next question was from somebody else. Don't think these two are connected. It's not that because that didn't happen, therefore the second question happened. The second question was, my pet, my dog, actually died on Yom Tov. It did not happen because I said not to make food. That was somebody else. These were two separate people. So the dog died on Yom Tov, and the question was, nobody wants a dead animal in their house on Yom Tov. So am I allowed to take the animal and dispose of it on Yom Tov? Obviously, you're not allowed to do a gura on Yom Tov. You're not allowed to dig into the ground. That would be a malacha. But let's say just take it outside of my house, put it in the backyard somewhere. I don't want it all around. So is that something that's permissible? So that's actually an interesting question. The Gemara actually discusses behema shemesa the Yom Tov. What's the halacha when you have a behema and you have an animal that dies on Yom Tov? The Gemara never fathomed that we could have a situation of a pet dying in your house on Yom Tov. The Gemara is talking about when people have farm animals outside in the backyard and it dies on Yom Tov, am I allowed to move it? Now, why did I want to move it? So the Gemara says I would want to move it, not because it's in my house and it's something that makes me uncomfortable, but rather because I want to take it to a place where the rest of my animals will be able to eat it. Now I have meat and I have something to serve them. Would I be allowed to move this dead animal, this carcass, to then serve it to the rest of my animals that are grazing somewhere else? Would that be permissible or not? A major discussion in the Gemara that really comes from in Machlokes HaPadayim, Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda, based on what is the status of Nola. When I have something that at the beginning, at the start of Shabbos or Yom Tov, was one way, and then the status changes somehow, so does that now change the relationship that I have with that item? Would it change my allowance to use that item, or do you say no? If at the start of Shabbos I was allowed to handle this item, then now that would continue. Now, on Shabbos, this is not really relevant for a behema, because we assume on Shabbos a behema is mutzah. You're not allowed to handle an animal on Shabbos. There's some kind of shmua, they say, the shame or emotion. I don't know where this comes from, about pets maybe being different. Anyone ever? Right? What? Oh, that lady. I'm not sure. I don't know that this has ever been actually verified, that Ramosha ever said such a thing. Did he write it? I don't think he ever wrote this. I think it's just going to be a shmua. People say, I don't know. People say that Rav Moshe said maybe his mother said Passover in Stannis. My father said he doesn't believe Rav Moshe ever said it, not because he ever spoke to Rav Moshe about it, but because he said if you look through the sugyas of Mutzah, it's just not so clear that Balei Chayim would be permissible just because I have them living in my house. So that's a questionable thing in the first place. That's on Shabbos is a major shaila of Mutzah. Even if Rav Moshe did say it, which I'm not sure, even if he did, it's a major chula. So understand that handling of that on Shabbos is a very, very serious shaila of Mutzah. On Yom Tov, handling an animal would be something that is probably a little bit simpler. Why? What? Because on Yom Tov, what did they used to do? They used to shech animals on Yom Tov in order to be able to use that for their meal. Now, would that carry over to a dog, which is never going to be used for ochel nefesh anyway? Probably not. But the Shulchan Aruch does say, either way, when it comes to Yom Tov, if something changes in status, we're actually more machmir on Yom Tov than we are on Shabbos. So if I had something that was permissible at the start of Shabbos, for example, what would be a good example? An apple. I had an apple, and I eat the apple. I don't eat the whole thing. The whole core of the apple I leave, all the pits I leave behind. So what do? After we finish eating it, we throw it out, we dispose of it. The Gemara says that on Shabbos, that would be permissible. On Yom Tov, you're not allowed to handle the leftover. Why not? Because that's nola. That's a change in status. This used to be an edible item when Shabbos and Yom Tov came in, and now it changed in its status, and it now became something new. Now it's no longer edible. So you have to deal with how you dispose of leftover food on Yom Tov. But the Shulchan Aruch does say we're more machmir on Yom Tov with Nola than we would be on Shabbos. And that's why I think this is a very interesting question. Even if you were to say that animals or pets would not be a violation of books on Shabbos or Yom Tov, when it comes to this situation, the Shulchan Aruch writes clearly that if the animal was not sick when Yom Tov came in, and there was no expectation that maybe the status would change over Yom Tov, then that would be a prohibition of Nola once it dies. And a behemoth from Nesa the Yom Tov would be Mutzah. So I think that would be the appropriate stock for this as well. Now, granted, it's very uncomfortable to have this in your home and to be everybody tripping over this and looking at it. So you have to figure out another solution. Maybe have an Ashur come in. I'm not sure if some of the other have an idea, but curious if you were confronted any of these issues.
Perhaps we could say that it's a what we call in Hilchos Mukta Grav Sholei, something that's I'm not a pet owner, so I don't want to sound insensitive, but it sounds disgusting. Got a dead dog running past. So the perhaps one could argue that it's perhaps a Grav Sholei, and if you have a Grav Sholei, it's something that's allowed to be moved with machinery, to move it to a place that wouldn't be disturbing to other people. But again, I'm not a pet owner. I don't understand.
Another shayla that came up, which was actually very touching shayla. Someone came up to me. He was actually here before he left, but someone came up to me on Yom Tov, on the second morning of Yom Tov, and he said that he noticed his father-in-law was with him for Yom Tov, and he noticed on the second morning that his father-in-law's esrog was missing his pitten. That pitten had fallen off. And he knew that his father-in-law would be very disappointed if he were to see that and to notice that. So he wanted to know, is he allowed to switch out his father-in-law's esrog for his esrog, and he'll share with his son. He'll provide his father-in-law with an esrog with a pitten, and the father-in-law will never be the wiser for it. He'll never know about it. And that way it will save him the aggravation of it. So I thought that was a very touching shayla. Everyone should, plus everyone here, that you should have such a nice son-in-law, so that are concerned for your aggravation. But it's a real problem, meaning you could definitely give him your esrog, and there maybe it has to even be lachem on Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyos, that's what to talk about. But you could be, even though he has no das to be koneh, you could do Zachalat and Shalom Bethana and be koneh on his behalf. But to steal his esrog, even if it's missing a pitten, that you probably are not allowed to do. I mean, it's also to steal, even a good intention stealing. The Gemara says in the Sakhba Metzia that, let's say, there's someone that needs money and you
want to be able to give them some money, but they're too proud. They refuse to take money. So you come up with a great idea. You're going to steal from them. Then basically will be required to pay kafel. So now you'll provide them with double the amount of money. So the Gemara says, great idea, usher to do. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to steal, even almanas l'shan kafel. So even when it's to the person's benefit, those almanas to make it, if you're just trying to aggravate the person. It's interesting. I just came across a oriented. There's a tshuva from Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger was the kind of person that Moreh Rav Shechter would refer to as a colorful personality. He was a very, very interesting person. He thought that if he was a big believer that we have all afternoon Eretz Yisrael, and he said, if your wife doesn't go, it doesn't want to go, so just marry another woman in Eretz Yisrael. Forget about it. He had a lot of very interesting shittos. But someone asked him about a shayla. There was a big kavir in the community that provided the esrog for the entire community. Every year he would buy a mahudar esrog, and he provided for the whole community. And one year, because it used to be that not everybody had an esrog, they had one in the community. A beautiful story about esrog kakushi. So one year this big kavir kind of threw a huge fight with everyone in the community on Eretz. And he said, I'm not sharing my esrog with anyone. And now the whole community didn't have an esrog. So Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger suggests to hire a guy to steal the esrog from him and then return it to him after everyone gets the mitzvah with it. And he suggests that going on the Mekka, that you're going to steal on the Hasir, is an isser for a Jew, but it's not an isser for a guy, so there's no thing either to do that. Very, very creative. Colorful personality, like I said, but for a Jew, you're not allowed to do things like this. So it's l'chora a problem. The guy said he tried it, and his father-in-law opened up his box and said, someone did a switcheroo, like he immediately got onto it. So.
Yes. I guess the last one that I'll discuss tonight is also a very nice gesture. A family in our shul is having people for a cholma meal one night, and they were not observant, non-observant Jews, and we wanted to give them a beautiful sukkah chaya. They wanted to give them an experience, but sitting in the sukkah is not enough. They also wanted them to wave dal minhag. They wanted to know, can they give them dal minhag to wave at night? Would that be an appropriate thing to do? So the Gemara says, means that you only take the lulav during the daytime, not at nighttime. There is a machlokas amongst the achronim. When it comes to lulav and dal minim, at night is it what we call mechusar zman, meaning is it a zero? Is it kemat not sukkas at all at night for your dal minim? The implication would be that, according to some opinions, there are two mukhs at night, because you can't take dal minim at night. It's mukhsa. It's a total zero. It's nothing. It's no different than taking a rose and taking an apple and doing the same thing. It's mukhsa's man. It's not sukkahs for that dal minhag. That's certainly not how we paskin. Rav Ashkenazi writes in Chaz Rav Ashkenazi sukkahs that we don't consider as if it's a zero and nothing for dal minhag. It is something at night. You don't fulfill the mitzvah of akhlan kavei orisha, but it is some relationship to the dal minhag themselves. But at the same time, initially, I was a bit hesitant because of a well-known story with Rabbi Kalamar, Sefer Tzadok LeBracha, and Rabbi Salvechik about the woman who wanted to wear a towel. So I'm not going to repeat the story right there. If you know, you know. If you don't, then you're going to find it for somebody else. But Rabbi Salvechik was very much against Judaism being ceremonies. Judaism is not ceremonies. We don't do things because it looks nice and makes us feel good. There's a shirk d'shanu, the mitzvos of the tzivanu. The mitzvos are real. It's not a joke. It's a real thing that has impact on us. We don't simply do ceremonies to make us feel good and to feel special about our Yiddishkeit. So on one hand, I was a bit not excited because, you know, they're going to turn the lulav and esrog into a ceremony. It's a nice thing. You know, we can't do it every day. It's night, and, you know, we'll play a game with it, and it'll perhaps be, I want it to be a joke in your eyes. But on second thought, I said I didn't feel that it was such a problem, because if you explain to the people that generally you take the dal minhag during the day, tonight is not the time to do the mitzvah, but I want you to take it, I want you to hold it, I want you to get the chinuch experience of what it is to take dal minhag, and in some way it would impact them in a positive way, I highly find it doubtful that in the future, if this family was to become frog, yes, Hashem, they're going to think back to, I remember, you can wave dal minhag at night.
I don't think that's going to be your lasting impression. Hopefully it'll be some sort of experiential thing. I saw that Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein was quoted in Sefer Barchi Nafshi, again, the Sefer Gracious, where he says that one is allowed to have somebody put on a tefillin at night for a bar mitzvah boy who is only going to have one opportunity and never see a parents home again. You have the opportunity to put tefillin on him, you can put it on at night. Because for the mitzvah, so you should know what tefillin is, and check if it's tefillin, you know, for whatever reason could be worn at night, you don't wear it at night because you don't want to fall asleep. So he felt in that reason. I don't know who the minhag is with Chabad for the tefillin. I don't know who the minhag Chabad is for davening. So Chabad, should come on the street, give out davening at night? I'd have to imagine they probably do. I don't know. I'd have to, someone can verify that to me, but verify that for me. But for the sake of chinuch, and to show that this is davening, and explain to them, this is for the sake of chinuch, and to see davening, I thought it would not be problematic. What?
No problem.
Okay, thank you everybody so much for coming to learn together. We should have many, many opportunities. Wishing everyone a good yontif, a good tiara, and a good fitness.